Me, Hannah Fry, on 10 extraordinary adventures of data and discovery on BBC Sounds and Radio 4, this Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45.
And this is BBC Radio 4. BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 7th of September. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. Donald Trump has said his conviction in his hush money trial should be terminated after a judge in New York delayed sentencing until after November's presidential election. The case relates to a payment to an adult film star just before Mr. Trump's victory in 2016. A prominent Republican, Dick Cheney, has described him as a threat to democracy and said he would vote for the Democratic Party's candidate, Kamala Harris. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
Donald Trump was found guilty of falsifying business records to conceal a payment he made to Stormy Daniels and could be sent to prison for up to 4 years. The judge said the delay in sentencing was necessary to avoid any appearance, however unwarranted, that the proceeding had been affected by or sought to affect the presidential election. While the delay was welcome news for the Republican candidate, his campaign has suffered a setback. The former Republican Vice President Dick Cheney has confirmed he'll be voting for Kamala Harris in November. Mr. Trump has dismissed him as irrelevant and a Republican in name only.
The new England football manager Lee Carsley has suggested he'll not be singing the national anthem when his side lines up for his first match in charge against the Republic of Ireland in Dublin this evening. The interim boss replaced Gareth Southgate this summer and is hoping to get the permanent job. Carsley, a former Irish international who was born in Birmingham, told the BBC he respected anthems, but singing might distract his focus.
I've never sung the national anthem for Ireland as I want for England. So, and that's just because of my own personal match preparation. I'm fully focused on the game. It was something that when I was playing for Ireland, I always struggled with the weight between warming up, going back into the dressing room, the walk in the tunnel, and then the weight while the anthems were on.
Sir Keir Starmer will be at the match as part of a visit to Dublin for talks with the Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris. Sir Keir said he wanted the UK's relationship with Ireland to reach its full potential. Mr. Harris called it an important moment of reset. Here's our Ireland correspondent Chris Page.
Boris Johnson was the last British Prime Minister to visit Dublin 5 years ago. The absence of a trip since then is a sign that ties were strained. Brexit was a factor in the cooling of relations. So too were differences between the two governments on the issue of how the troubles in Northern Ireland should be investigated. But Sir Keir Starmer's indicated he wants to rejuvenate the UK's relationship with its close neighbour. This will be his third meeting with an EU leader in recent weeks, following trips to France and Germany. Sir Keir and Simon Harris will discuss trade links with Irish business executives from companies including Primark and Accenture.
The government is expected to introduce legislation next week to ban landlords in England from evicting tenants without a reason. The Renters' Rights Bill also extends social housing safety rules to the private sector and looks to make it easier for renters to own pets. An empty spacecraft has landed back on Earth without its two crew members. Boeing Starliner experienced technical problems shortly after launching, prompting NASA to leave the astronauts on board the International Space Station until February. The original mission was due to last 8 days. In tennis, the Britain's men's number one Jack Draper has been knocked out of the US Open in a grueling semi-final match against the world number one Jannik Sinner. Draper was sick 3 times during the match, later saying the pressure had made him nauseous. Despite the loss, he said he was proud of his performance against the best in the world.
There's nothing more I can do, honestly. I probably look back at the match and sort of see myself struggling a bit, but I know in the moment when I was out there, I couldn't do any more. You know, I was fighting to give everything. I'm just not quite there yet.
That's the BBC News. We'll take a look at the papers in a minute after Sarah Keith Lucas has given us today's weather forecast.
Thanks, Alan. Well, yesterday we saw the warmest day of the year so far for Northern Ireland. Temperatures there reached 27 Celsius, as they did across parts of Western Scotland. We had 28 down towards Cambridge as well. Now, today it's going to be another day of big contrast. So again, some warm sunshine in the north and the west, but we're losing that heavy rain that's been plaguing southern parts of England and Wales over recent days. So for the southern half of England and Wales, it is going to stay quite cloudy, quite murky. We've got some fog out there. There'll also be a few showers developing through parts of southwest England, south Wales into the Midlands as well. But many areas will actually avoid them through the day. And temperatures here around about 20 to 24 degrees. For Northern England, Northern Ireland and Scotland, then early morning mist and fog mainly clearing. Best of the sunshine will be for Western Scotland and Northern Ireland, again where temperatures reach around about 24 or 25 degrees. But for eastern parts of Northern England and for eastern Scotland, the cloud will gradually burn back towards the coast, but it could stay quite murky all day.
Thank you, Sarah. Time now for a look at the papers. And the Daily Telegraph takes a dim view of Lee Carsley's suggestion that he won't sing the national anthem as he takes charge of England for the first time. The paper's chief football correspondent, Jason Burt, says Carsley is being naive and shouldn't be managing the national side if he doesn't sing God Save the King ahead of his inaugural match. The Daily Mail says the Football Association should sack Carsley if he doesn't sing the national anthem. The Guardian leads on the government's plans to introduce a renters' rights bill next week, which it calls a major victory for campaigners. The paper notes that the bill is a central plank in Labour's plans for the housing market, but that landlords have warned ending no-fault evictions could lead to an overwhelming number of court cases. According to The Times, the number of wealthy Britons looking to move abroad has surged since Labour came to power. They're said to be concerned about the Chancellor's tax plans for the autumn budget. The paper said one company offering relocation services to high net worth individuals has seen a 69% spike in inquiries last month compared with August last year. A Treasury spokesman said difficult decisions would be made in the budget to fill a £22 billion funding gap. And give back your gong, fury, as Sir Ian badmouths the Queen, is the headline on the front of the Daily Express, referring to comments the veteran actor Sir Ian McKellen made in another paper, The Times. In an interview about his latest film, Sir Ian said that the late Queen Elizabeth II had been rude during the ceremony, making him a companion of honour, when she asked him if anyone still went to the theatre. And that's our look at the papers. This is BBC Radio 4. Now, Open Country takes us on the Hebridean Whale Trail on the island of Mull to learn about citizen science and responsible wildlife watching.
This is the harbour at Tobermory on the island of Mull. This week, Open Country is here to find out how the balance between tourism and nature is being preserved by people working on the island who want to encourage people to see the things they've come to see, such as sea eagles, whales and otters, but also to respect and protect them.
It's a lovely spot though, the lighthouse, isn't it?
My name's Morven and I am the Communications Manager at the Hebridean Whale and Dolphin Trust.
My name's Sadie, I'm the Education and Sightings Officer at the Hebridean Whale and Dolphin Trust. We collect sightings data on whales, dolphins, porpoises and basking sharks, and the goal for that is to understand the presence and absence of these animals in our waters.
So we're on the path here to the Tobermory Lighthouse at Runagal. It is one of our Hebridean Whale Trail sites. So the Hebridean Whale Trail is a network of 30 land-based sites across the west coast of Scotland. Some of them are really great spots to watch from, but others have more cultural ties to whales and dolphins. So, for example, one of the sites on the Isle of Col is the fin whale arch, so the jaw of a fin whale that washed ashore. And then another, for example, is the old whaling station on Harris. So people were actively whaling up until the 1950s off the west coast of Scotland. And it's really important to remember and to understand our whaling past, not to sort of shame it in any way, but to remember it and to be aware that it did happen. And that shift between exploitation and protection now that's happening with whales and dolphins.
What are the most common species around Mull, Morven?
The most common species we find around Mull, in fact, well, the west coast of Scotland even, to widen it out, are the harbour porpoise. The Hebrides is actually one of the most important places in Europe for harbour porpoise. We also have a small resident population of bottlenose dolphins, and a very small sort of semi-resident population of killer whales called the West Coast Community. Minke whales are abundant in our seas, are one of the most common whale species that we have here. They arrive in the summer months to feed in our rich waters. We also have a large number of common dolphins.
Do you find people come here specifically for a kind of wildlife holiday?
Definitely. Wildlife tourism is a big player on Mull. And some people can do it responsibly, whereas others, I think with the rise of, again, it's the positives and negatives of social media and with wildlife film documentaries, where people have this expectation that they're going to see this breaching whale or this seagull fly close by them, and they'll get that shot for their Instagram or for their gallery or their cat, you know. But actually, the reality of wildlife watching is you just see a glimpse sometimes, and or not even that. You could be hanging about and not seeing anything. So we do have a lot of wildlife tourism. Some of it is great and positive, but sometimes people do overstep that mark, and they can, in the efforts to get that really good picture, they can end up disturbing the animals that they've come to see. Rocket lines. So over here is the mainland, is what we can see. Arden American Peninsula and then the Morven Peninsula over here.
So that's where the two orca were spotted, wasn't it?
Just over Arden American, but more round the coast here.
Just yesterday, was it?
Just yesterday, yeah, off the north coast. They've actually been around for about a week now.
Well, I know we shouldn't get overexcited about the apex predators,
no.
The big guys, but I have to say, my fingers are massively, massively crossed.
Yeah.
That would be a thrill.
I think it's, particularly for the John Cone Aquarius, their story's a tragic one. So I think that every time that you see them or you hear, it's almost like this could be the last time. And that does carry a bit of weight. It does, you know, it does pull in those emotional sort of ties that... that sometimes as a scientist you don't want to embrace, but you know, knowing their story, it is special when you see them.
John Cone Aquarius are what we believe to be the remaining members of the West Coast community. We've not seen any of the other individuals since 2016, interestingly. John Cone, who is a male, thought to be around 60 years old, and Aquarius, who's probably a similar age, maybe a bit younger. And they are being seen now quite a lot, not only on the West Coast, but also across the UK. They were seen confirmed for the first time down in England in 2021 off the Cornish coast and also off of Dover. And they're seen quite regularly each year around the Irish coast as well. When they are seen, there's a bit of a sigh of relief because, you know, they're still around, because the next sighting could very well be the last sighting. So everyone gets very excited when a report of them turns up, which kind of leads on to kind of the excitement of individuals being kind of having that celebrity status. So John Cone very much does have that celebrity status among the whale community, and everyone usually flocks to the coasts to spot them when they have been seen.
Why him particularly?
I think just because he's got kind of that aura about him. He's very identifiable. He's got this huge nick in the base of his dorsal fin, and he is like one of the largest. Like, they can grow over 9 meters in size, so he is quite a unique individual. And then obviously, yeah, he's got his friend Aquarius with him, who also gets just as much attention, but usually it's John Coe's name that comes first.
And we should say Aquarius is also male.
Aquarius is also male, yes.
Which means that eventually those two, when they go, the West Coast community is extinct.
Yeah, unfortunately, because of the last two that we know of being males and none of the females being seen in recent years, it is very likely that when those two go, that will be the extinction of the West Coast community.
Much of what we know about the West Coast community is down to people reporting what they've seen, and we've never ever had a report of the West Coast community interacting with members of the Northern Isles, because quite often we're asked, could the females from that population not just mate with these two? But actually, there's never been an instance that we know of, and there's never been a report of the two mixing together. They're quite distinct, about a metre bigger. As Sadie said, they're bigger, the West Coast community, and they have a different eye patch orientation. So they're, in some parts of the world, orca populations have been split into subspecies now that they're so distinct, and it could be that's the case here too.
Is there anything the public can and should do to protect them?
What we ask is that people report their sightings. That's really helping unravel the story of the West Coast community, and understanding their story, we can hopefully then roll that out across the world so that other orca populations don't meet that same fate.
What we would ask is that people are respectful. Quite often when reports do occur, you sometimes get this a semblance of boats mobilising to the spot, and that can cause quite a lot of disruption to the pier. You know, we quite often advocate for responsible wildlife watching. Sadie trains local boat operators in how to interact responsibly around creatures. So, for example, what, you stay only 15 minutes?
Yeah, so we follow kind of the WISE guidance, which is wildlife safe. The guidance really is, yeah, to stay no more than 15 minutes with the animals. Even if they're in the area for a longer period of time, you can move away from them and give them that break. We also say to be considerate of how many other boats are in the area. So that two's company, three's a crowd sort of quote does have merit here. So if there are already two boats in the area, consider keeping your distance. Or if you're one of those two boats, consider leaving the area so somebody else can have a short look at the animals, but also just keeping your distance. Like, these animals are huge. You can see them really clearly from a distance, and even better if you've got binoculars, you don't have to get close to them. Like, we do recommend 100 meters, or if they're feeding, even 400 meters. But it's also considering that cumulative effect. Like, you might be doing all of the correct responsible guidance, and every other boat might also be doing that, but if you consider that there might be 20 boats out there each staying 15 minutes, those animals aren't getting a break all day. So consider that cumulative effect that you're having on these animals. They're very sensitive animals, and obviously with them being potentially the last two, we do just want to keep them as protected as possible and not to disturb them from, you know, if they're feeding.
And those rules apply to all sea creatures, really. I think people seem to think because the ocean's a vast place that, you know, how are we disturbing these creatures? They could just swim away. But actually, we know so little about these creatures. What we think is not being, they could be doing something really important for all we know, and we've stopped them doing that. And as Sadie says, it's that cumulative nature. So yeah, it's just about having a bit of respect, giving animals a bit of space to go about their day-to-day lives.
But also, like, watching from land can be really, like, so rewarding. Like, you don't have to go out on a boat. We're really lucky, not just in Scotland but across the UK, we've got these stunning coastlines with beautiful viewpoints, and these animals are so large, not just killer whales but, you know, minke whales, bottlenose dolphins. These are large animals, and if you just stand on a hilltop for like half an hour watching out with binoculars, you're likely going to see something, and you don't have to be really close to them to get that spectacular sight.
I mean, not anywhere around the coast of the UK you've got a chance. So what you need is patience. We like to advocate for a sort of slower approach to wildlife watching, so not going with any expectation that you're going to see something, because that sort of sets you up for a fall, but going with a bit of hope that you might, you know, spending a bit of time in nature, casting your eye out over the sea, and if you see something, it almost makes it all the more special for me. It's that opportunistic, oh, like, and if there's people around you, share it with them, and it just makes for a really lovely, meaningful experience, as opposed to, I've got this list of creatures I want to see, and if I don't see them, I'm going to be disappointed. You know, we're big advocates of that slower approach to it, and just taking it all in, you know, and not going out with the big apex predators in mind, because if you look for the big stuff, you miss the wee stuff.
How have social media and the huge increase in wildlife programmes on TV affected the way the public interact with these creatures?
I think there's kind of two different ways that they've had an impact. So I remember when, like, Blue Planet came out, that had a huge impact on people realising the impact we have on the marine environment. It's bringing the marine environment, the wildlife, to people who maybe don't actually get to experience it as often as we do. Not everyone's lucky enough to be around the coast. And it's the same with social media. Social media can be quite controversial. It can have some negative sides. But on the positive side of social media, it is getting that messaging across that these animals are in our waters. We are lucky to see them. And, you know, we have a lot of advocates out there who do share that responsible watching message amongst their community. Communities. And a lot of the sighting reports that come in go into sighting Facebook groups or social media groups, and then more people can get out and enjoy those animals. And even the Humpback Whale Catalogue, that was launched by just a member of the public who just got so inspired by humpbacks and the sightings that were coming in, that she set up the Humpback Whale Catalogue. And it is so successful now. Everyone is just reporting all the different humpbacks that they're seeing. Yeah. So I think community groups, social media groups, even WhatsApp groups are really useful in sharing the sightings. But the key message I would say is to then just make sure that those sightings are recorded officially, getting that data into a place that can actually then use it to share it with government and prove certain areas are important, yeah, is kind of the vital side of things.
We have an app, WheelTrack, which is free and super easy to use. It's got built-in ID guides. It's got step-by-step instructions on how to report. And every sighting submitted is so significant, from a single harbour porpoise through to a pod of killer whales. You know, it's so important to document each and every animal that people come across in our seas.
I'm Jan, and I'm the ranger for Mull and Iona. We're at Calgary, lovely big sandy bay, one of the nicest, most accessible beaches on Mull, and probably the most popular. And there's people out swimming.
Currently very much in vogue is otter spotting, but it's something that Mull's wildlife ranger Jan Dunlop is concerned about.
Seagulls used to be the big thing, but they now seem to have taken slightly a step back, and now it really seems to be otters. And it all kind of goes in line with, I think, photography and social media and what people are seeing on the television, and everybody wants their bit of it as well. Somebody's got a Facebook page, you know, and part of their promotion is, you know, Mull's bigger than an otter. There's more to Mull than otters. There's more to Mull than seagulls. You know, you look at the flowers, you look at the Flinders Scott Burnett moss. You know, we've got a lot of little stuff, but people focus on otters.
And has it always attracted people coming here for the wildlife, or do you feel like that's increased over the last few years, whether it's social media or lots of TV programmes, I wonder?
I think all the TV programmes, you know, Spring Watch, yeah, I think definitely is wildlife.
What are the negative impacts of wildlife tourism here?
I think there's a fashion with otter photography that, you know, looking down on an otter is not the best photo. You have to be eyeballing it. And that then means you have to be down near the water's edge in order to get that eyeball picture. And that's not always, you know, that's not always positive for the otter. You know, some people say that, oh, yeah, the otter's tolerant. The otter shouldn't have to be tolerant. You know, the people should respect the otter and give the otters space. So that's my biggest issue. I mean, I would quite like nobody to go low below high tide. And that'd be it. That would give them, you know, that's a measured space that they have. And the lenses that people have nowadays, I don't think they need to be so close, but they do. And, you know, the majority behave responsibly. Not all, but the majority do. But then if somebody sees somebody behaving irresponsibly, they then think, oh, well, it's OK for him to do it. I'll do it. And that's not what we want either, you know. And we have had support from TV stars Yolo Williams and Gordon Buchanan, who's a Mull native. You know, he's all supported what we're trying to do about, you know, respect otters, respect wildlife, respect space, respect community, because it all impacts on the community as well. I mean, there's one location where, you know, it's almost just out somebody's door and they're constantly seeing bad behaviour, and it just, you know, aggravates them.
And so bad behaviour is getting too close, stressing the animal, and then what effect would that have on the otter population?
Well, you know, they say that they're tolerant, and you kind of question it. I mean, I was speaking to a friend that was out doing wildlife studies in New Zealand, and she was saying that, I can't remember what the creature was, but they thought it was tolerant, but actually when they measured its heartbeat, it went through the roof when there was people involved. So, you know, you may think that the otter's tolerant because it's coming along and it's swimming and it's eating its food and it's coming ashore. And some of them are, but not all of them, you know, not all of them are quite as happy to do that. And they'll just take off if they're not happy. And they won't go out to sea, but they'll go away down the shore. But then the problem is that people follow them. And, you know, and they may have cubs somewhere. And if you're, you know, following down and keeping after them, it puts them either further away from their cubs, or it's just not ideal, really. Just have your time with the otter and then let it go off and do its own thing. We've got a couple of Facebook pages on Mull that are purely about wildlife, and a lot of the pictures are otters, and you think, can you not, you know, photograph an orchid? Or, you know, and at one point there's an otter that's got a scratch on his nose, and he was coming up every day on social media because he was quite accommodating in general. And you think, well, he obviously didn't get much peace because he was, you know, his photo was constantly coming up. And, you know, and I appreciate that wildlife brings a huge amount of money to Mull, but it's getting the balance and it's knowing when to give them, you know, stand back and let them have a bit of space. We had a seasonal ranger and they basically spent their time just going round the hot spots, not telling people off, but just educating people about how to do it responsibly and, you know, yeah, watch them, but then move on and, you know, and go and find another otter somewhere else or go and find some other wildlife. And, you know, my job this year, I mean, at the moment I can do about a day a week on it, but, you know, really you need somebody on it full time all summer because I could get a phone call and say, oh, such and such, there's a white van looking at this and he's not behaving very well. And I'm in Tobermory and this is halfway down the middle of Mull. By the time I've got there, they've gone. And also, I try and keep an eye on what's going on Facebook so that if people are saying stuff on Facebook that's maybe not so appropriate or giving away locations, you kind of say, well, come on, you know, can you take that down or can you just change it? And I think that's the only way. We've got lots of tour operators that do land-based tours, and the majority, I would say, are pretty responsible. But at the end of the day, they want to get their customers a picture of an otter. So it's getting the message out that, yes, otters need respect and space as well as everybody else, you know. You try and not move when the otter's above the water, so that, and you try and stay downwind from them so they don't smell you, so you're not disturbing them. So you only move when they're swimming underwater, really. You know, don't follow an otter way up the shore because that, you know, that's pushing them probably out of where they're comfortable. Yeah, and just, yeah, give them space.
It's relatively calm today, so the conditions are perfect for spotting. We can look around here to see the coastline of Mull, Bloody Bay, the Ardmore Peninsula here, and then the Sound of Mull out into the Sea of the Hebrides up ahead. And next up we have Ardnamurchan Peninsula, and that follows round up through here to Lough Sunart. There's a mountain here, Ben Hiant, up into Lough Sunart, and then across from that we've got the Morven Peninsula.
Shall we have a wee scan just now then?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I mean, as you say, you don't really need it for the orca because, and they come quite close to shore.
They can, yeah, they can.
But the fins are so distinctive and large that it's the other smaller stuff.
But the smaller stuff can be quite fleeting. Particularly the harbour porpoise, they're not very gregarious. Yeah. They don't leap, well, they don't usually leap out of the water. We've had some reports of the Clyde recently of them doing the exact opposite, but they generally don't leap out of the water. And they're in usually quite small groups.
Binoculars out.
Yep, just scanning the sea here. As you say, it's a fleeting moment, so if you kind of blink, you can miss it. So it's really important just to try and keep a bit of focus.
Scan kind of left to right.
Scan kind of left to right. We usually do a figure of eight, don't we? You kind of...
Yeah, and also just scanning with your eyes sometimes, because obviously binoculars can really zero into one area and strain your eyes. So scanning with binoculars, scanning with your eyes, looking out for those telltale signs, like if there's any feeding birds or if there's like a splash that you see. It could be a diving bird, but, you know, it could also be an animal that's just breached the surface. So, yeah, looking for those sort of like indicators that something is in the area.
Yeah. It's just about educating and for people to understand that what we do has an impact. And although Mull is seen as this mecca for wildlife, species are still vulnerable. You know, the human activity is having an impact on species across the board, not just the marine environment, but terrestrial as well. And we still lack a basic understanding of these animals. You know, we've been collecting data for over 30 years, but that's the life cycle of one whale. You know, it's when you look at it a broader perspective, it's the long-term nature of data collection is so important to understand that change over time. You know, last year was a great year for minke whale sightings. Some of the years previous wasn't so much. So you get these blips and peaks and troughs, but it's understanding over the long term that has you can really build up that understanding of the population level, how they're doing overall.
How important do you think it is then with the work that you're doing, which is this citizen science approach, how important is that to get across to people rather than just sheer chasing the thrill.
Yeah.
I think it's hugely important. Like, we obviously have Sileria in our research vessel where people can come aboard and take part in the citizen science and become marine mammal scientists, but that's just one boat and we can't be everywhere. So having, you know, we've got 6,000 registered users on Whale Track. So having those eyes on the sea across Scotland is hugely important. And if those people are reporting everything that they're seeing and not just sharing it in their local sightings groups so that everyone can sort of see that, they are then not only enjoying that sighting and helping other people and inspiring other people, they are also contributing hugely to science and the protection of these animals.
Not seeing anything is just as valuable. Even if you don't see anything, you can have a positive impact on science.
If we can show that we've got just as much data in another area, but we're seeing nothing there compared to an area where we're always seeing something, we've got then that evidence to show that actually this area is clearly more important than this area. This is the one that should be protected and considered more. So, yeah, that absence data is still hugely important. And it just means that you've had a lovely day out watching the sea. Even if you've not seen anything, you've contributed to science.
Yep.
It looks like we might be having a lovely day out watching the sea and not actually seeing it. We've been here a while now.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of wildlife watching. Sometimes you see something, sometimes you don't. And it's just about approaching it with the hope that you will rather than that expectation that you will.
Open Country was produced by Maggie Eyre and it was a BBC Audio Bristol production for BBC Radio 4.
If you're looking for laughs,
this is where the magic happens.
BBC iPlayer's got you covered.
Good. Life is interesting at last.
With over 3,000 episodes of comedy favourites.
They make for great entertainers.
I need a shortlist.
Including The Office, Two Doors Down, The Thick of It, and many more.
Oh, what is that?
Whoa. Put my staple inside a jelly again.
Bring on the laughs.
What are you laughing at?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
We'll join the Today programme at 7 o'clock, but now here on Radio 4, it's time for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week, a blue tongue vaccine, a seabed recovery and our £100 million worth of cuts coming to the farming budget.
Well, I think DEFRA is going to be subject to exactly the same pressures as the other government departments. One of the challenges for DEFRA is that it's not central to the government mission boards.
More on that later. First, green finance. Now, if you've been up early and caught our sister programme, Farming Today, which is on at 5:45 every weekday morning here on BBC Radio 4, you'll know that we've been looking at this all week. It's basically defined as getting money to pay for things which improve nature or reduce harmful emissions, and so it offers opportunities for farmers. There are, though, increasing green finance opportunities, and it can all be a bit bewildering. So more and more companies are stepping in to broker deals between farmers and investors. Natigal's business model is to deliver ecological restoration on its own land and that of others, and then commercialise the results. Bob Worker visited their first site, Boothby Wildland in Lincolnshire, a 617-hectare arable farm. The company bought it in December 2021 and has since been gradually removing fields from intensive cereal production. He met with head of Natural Capital, Ivan de Clay.
So I'm standing next to a blackthorn sapling that has popped up in the last 3 years since we stopped farming this section of the farm. And that has a scrubland value. We will calculate how many units we are generating here, and we will hope to sell those to developers who are looking to comply with the biodiversity net gain legislation to go ahead with their developments. This soil is in really bad nick. It's been ploughed for many decades. It's lost its biological functions. One of the things we're hoping to do is recover those soils through natural processes. And in that process, we will be sequestering carbon in those soils. And that is another ecosystem service we hope to sell. And that will take the form of a carbon credit.
Would you ever turn down an investor, something like an oil company?
Absolutely we would, yeah. We are not trying to enable business as usual. The only people we want to sell carbon to are those companies or organisations who have already committed to dropping their emissions massively. We want them to aim for net zero by 2050, for example. We will help them mitigate for the bits that they can't do in that time period.
My name is Ben Hart. I'm the head of operations at Nattergal. My job is to run the sites that we have, as well as the community engagement programmes as well.
This won't be a way for companies to greenwash.
If an organisation has the appropriate trajectory and it is aligned with the science, then we will work with them. But up to that point, we are very clear that we are not going to enable greenwashing.
Now, as we've been walking around here, we have seen in the distance a combine operating. So it's still a working farm.
We have staggered our transition from arable farming into free roaming grazing, and we staggered it over a period of three harvests and did so that we would have a variety of different vegetation successional stages. And this is our last harvest, so this is the final time the combine will be out on this relatively poor quality arable land over, I don't know, for at least 100 years, who knows. But it's a momentous moment, because as of today we will be transitioning into a completely wildlife biodiversity driven system.
One of the criticisms of operations like this is that it is changing local communities, the way communities have existed and operated for centuries.
When we took over the site, there was one person employed. We now employ three local people, and we've worked really hard to engage with all the different stakeholders, and that is the local landowners and the local farmers. It's also the local communities. A lot of the community who live around here, the main engagement they have with the land is walking their dogs on the farm. As part of that engagement, we're looking at adding an extra 2.5 kilometres of accessible, permissible paths.
Yeah, just add that landscapes like these are always changing. You mentioned the farming culture here would have been the same for centuries. That's just simply not the case. 100 years ago, this was a pasture farm, 99 fields, and now it's an arable farm made up of 30 fields. The farmhouse here was built less than 15 years ago. So it's not a family who's been here for 100 years. It's a family who was here for 15 years and worked for a farming business up the road. We all know the problems of rural depopulation. We want to repopulate the countryside. We want to bring the volunteers here. We want to work with our neighbours. We want to employ local people.
But nevertheless, all that said, the big criticism of rewilding is you are taking land out of food production. And that's what's happened here.
Yes, whilst that is happening, we also need to recognise that we are in a biodiversity apocalypse, to put it mildly. We're not proposing all land like this is rewilded. Yeah, we acknowledge that we're taking land out of production here, but we think this land is the right land to do that on. And this biodiverse region will support food production in the wider landscape, whether that's through pollination services or restored soils.
Ivan de Clay there with Bob Walker. More on green finance on BBC Sounds. Just search for Farming Today. Rural areas across England are in danger of becoming pharmacy deserts as medicine providers across the country continue to consolidate and close smaller branches. Well, that's according to a study published this week by the National Pharmacy Association, or NPA, which shows that over the last 2 years, nearly 9 in 10 council areas in England have lost pharmacies. It found that rural areas often rely on fewer providers, so are harder hit by closures. Anna Hill spoke to Nick Kay, who runs several pharmacies in Cornwall, where he represents community pharmacies. He's also chair of the NPA.
Over the past couple of years, we've had 1,500 pharmacies closed. And unfortunately, most of those closures have been in rural areas, probably because 90% of income of those pharmacies in those particular areas comes from NHS services. You won't see lots of health and beauty counters and things like that. So when community pharmacy funding is primarily from the NHS, and the NHS funding has been completely flat for the last 5 years, that's obviously going to cause a huge amount of financial pressure.
You are demanding more government funding, but pharmacies generally are making enough money to cover their less profitable outlets, aren't they? I mean, I'll just quote you some figures that came out just this week. Day Lewis, which is a large pharmacist operating across England, it's just reported sales topping £500 million, although profits are down from last year. But surely those big pharmacies, can't they afford to fund their rural branches?
Those particular results are not necessarily indicative of the entire sector. And even if you've got large pharmacies or small pharmacies, all of them have been at risk. So most of your listeners will have understood that Lloyd's Pharmacies now doesn't exist. That was the second largest pharmacy chain in the country of over 1,000 branches, and now that is no longer in existence.
You actually work in pharmacy yourself. Why do you need more government funding? What's happened to make you need more money?
Yeah, so I am the CEO of Community Pharmacy Cornwall as well as working in pharmacies in Cornwall. And actually what's happened with it is that community pharmacy funding has been completely flat over the last 5 years. That's meant that people have had to sort of reduce and cut hours of service. So there used to be a thing where some pharmacies had to be contractually open for 100 hours, which meant they would be open at times which were maybe more convenient, weekends and evenings. And now the government have said that they don't have to open for 100 hours anymore. They only have to open for 72 hours. And in fact, businesses large and small have reduced their opening hours. And I see that on my patch, especially in the far west of Cornwall, that really rural area where pharmacies are having to cut their opening hours, and almost you can get a desert of pharmacy provision sort of late on a Sunday afternoon. And listeners will understand those rural areas, things may not be very far on a map, but with things with public transport in those rural areas, actually accessing that healthcare can be really problematic, Anna.
Shouldn't pharmacies be investing in different approaches, perhaps, like automated dispensing and collection kiosks? I know they exist in some areas. Wouldn't that help?
Automation is, and collection kiosks is, an increase in technology is something that most pharmacies would want to embrace. The problem with it is if you've had flat funding, the ability to actually invest in those things is then reduced. And it's one of the hardest parts of my job as chair of the National Pharmacy Association is people ring me up and say, this is a third generation business. I've remortgaged my house. I haven't told my partner. When's it going to get better? Because these people really want to serve the communities that they're embedded in. There is no lack of desire to invest in those things, but in crude terms, the cash just isn't there in most businesses, Anna.
And what is the effect then on rural communities, people who need their medicine?
The effect is actually people potentially not being able to access medicine at the time they wanted. Maybe the pharmacy's closed. And the other things as well is if pharmacies aren't there to deal with some of those minor things, then people end up driving to hospitals, A&Es and all those other things where pharmacies could help.
Nick Kay from the National Pharmacy Association. A Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson told us, pharmacies are key to our plans to make healthcare fit for the future as we shift the focus of the NHS out of hospitals and into the community. We will make better use of pharmacists' skills, including rolling out independent prescribing to improve access to care. Now, some welcome good news this week in the recovery of a seabed. Research from the University of Plymouth showed that the bed off Devon, which had been damaged by years of trawling and dredging, has been transformed in just 10 years. And as Andrea Ormsby from BBC Spotlight reports, it's all because of muscle power.
Farming underwater. In clear blue sea, line after line of rope falls vertically from the surface to the seabed, each one teeming with mussels, and zigzagging their way through like slalom skiers, hundreds of fish. This is Lyme Bay off the South Devon coast, home to the UK's largest offshore mussel farm. It's a business and a research project.
My name's John Homeyard. I'm the managing director of Offshore Shellfish. The business is farming mussels on ropes, and it's a unique opportunity because no one's built a farm of this scale in that sort of location before, anywhere. And so we were very keen to see what the effect of the farm would be. So before we actually started, the whole place was surveyed by Plymouth University, and then we've continued that survey every year since.
One of the scientists involved in this research right from the start is Dr. Emma Sheehan, an associate professor in marine conservation with the University of Plymouth.
Well, after years of dredging and trawling, the seabed we found there is just lots of silty, muddy sediments, lots of scavenging species, but very functionally benign. You know, that's all we saw there. We were really surprised to
see how quickly we were seeing positive changes associated with the farm. Straight away, we were seeing mussel clumps that had fallen from the ropes and started to create these reefs that we're now seeing. And straight away, you're starting seeing cuttlefish maybe using them to lay eggs. And, you know, it's really, really quick. But now, we know, we've been doing this for 10 years and we've seen a third increase in fish, whether they're in the water column around the ropes or on the seabed. We've seen 50% increases in the diversity of animals that live within the sediments, so they're oxygenating the sediments. And so just everything we look at is just positive increases.
The company behind this farm harvests around 3,000 tonnes of mussels a year, most of them exported to Holland and from there onto Belgium and northern France.
The production of mussels in Europe has actually decreased by about 100,000 tonnes in the last 20 years, mostly because of poor water quality and a lot of other issues. Lack of space is one of them. So the fact that we figured out a way of growing them offshore in exposed waters opens up a tremendous opportunity. I think the key thing we're showing is that shellfish farming or aquaculture of the type that we do can coexist with fishing and biodiversity, and it's pretty much a win-win-win situation for all of us.
And the years of research back that up. A new report released by the University of Plymouth has revealed that mussel power is revitalising and restoring centuries-old shellfish reefs.
Oh, we're so excited. You know, we love it when you find like a human activity that's actually having a positive effect. And so not only is this creating sustainable form of protein production, but then to also have these added benefits of restoring our broken seabed habitats. It's a really exciting thing to find.
The team here is now being contacted by people from across the world keen to try to replicate this success story.
That report from Andrea Ormsby. Now, we've been reporting over the past few weeks on increasing numbers of cases of blue tongue. Now, the government has agreed to the emergency use of three vaccines within the UK to try and stop it spreading. Blue tongue is a virus carried by biting midges blown into the UK from Northern Europe. It's currently widespread, particularly in the Netherlands. It can infect sheep, cattle, goats, deer and camelids, but not humans, nor does it pose any risk to the food chain. It is, however, unpleasant for animals that contract it, and it can be lethal. Temporary control zones, which restrict the movement of livestock, have been established in the areas where it's been confirmed. Nick Whitehead keeps sheep within the zone in Suffolk. He says it's having an impact on his business.
So I would sell to Colchester Market, which is outside the restricted zone that I know of at the moment. So can't do that. Everything has to stay on site. We don't know till when. You really have no control where the midges will fly. Just a big worry. Nothing we really can do.
Well, the approval of these new vaccines comes just after the confirmation of a new case of blue tongue in an area that's previously been unaffected, the East Riding of Yorkshire, just north of the Humber estuary. That takes the total number of infected premises up to 21. Christine Middlemas is the UK's chief vet. Kaz Graham asked her about the likely source of infection for this new case in Yorkshire.
It looks very much likely that it is midges blown over from the Netherlands that have created this case. We do think in a premise in Suffolk, one of the first premises where we've sampled all the animals, there has been some local spread. So the risk now is about our own midges picking it up.
And do our local midges get it by biting infected livestock? Because, I mean, the virus itself isn't contagious. It's not spread from cow to cow or sheep to sheep. It's just spread by midges, isn't it?
Yep, you're absolutely right. So infected midges blew over from the continent. They bit an animal here, and then it takes only one bite to create an infection. That animal becomes infected, and then our local UK midges bite that infected animal. They fly to another animal in the herd or maybe one next door for their next meal. When they bite, they create infection in that animal. So it is midge spread, but the point of the movement restrictions is to stop long-distance movement of infected animals because they could take the virus to midges in a clean area.
Tell me about the vaccines that DEFRA has permitted the use of, and also why have they only been approved for use now when the virus has been in the UK for, well, more than 10 days at least?
Okay, so these vaccines are very newly developed and they have not gone through the full safety and efficacy testing process. The Veterinary Medicines Directorate have looked at them and they believe they don't have any deleterious effects. Given the situation we're in, the Secretary of State has decided to permit their use without them being authorised. We now have to create a licence for them to be used for blue tongue under the blue tongue regulations, and we will be targeting their use in the restricted area in the first instance.
So how long will it take to get that licence up and running?
A few days and 2 weeks. It's important to recognise for the vaccine, it is not fully protective. So it will not stop your animal becoming infected and it will not stop it being infectious to midges. But the evidence from the continent is that it is suppressing the virus. So they're not having as many clinical signs and they're not having as many deaths.
Okay, and are you able to estimate how severe this year's spread of the virus is going to be, going on the evidence that you have now?
Well, it is a moving picture, so anything you say is only an estimate. And, you know, midges are weather dependent, so it really, really depends on what happens to the weather, particularly temperatures, over the coming weeks. But what we would expect is some ongoing local spread in the restricted area and potentially a bit beyond the restricted area. We are doing surveillance testing to test, look along the boundaries of the restricted area and try and have that ahead of where actual clinical infection is happening.
Christine Middlemiss, the UK's chief vet. The government plans to cut the budget for nature-friendly farming in England by £100 million. Well, that's according to a report in The Guardian this week. It claims that civil service sources say the cut is needed to help fill a £22 billion Treasury shortfall. Well, the reduced spending is reported to be from the new Sustainable Farming Incentive, the SFI, which replaces the old EU system. It pays farmers for environmental benefits produced on their land. Nature and farming groups have reacted with consternation. Well, we contacted the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs and the Treasury. Neither would confirm nor deny that the budget would be cut. £100 million is the same amount that the previous government had been accused of underspending on environmental programmes from the DEFRA budget, which totals £2.4 billion for England. Well, the issue was raised in the House of Commons this week by the Liberal Democrat Environment spokesperson Tim Farron in questions to the Chancellor.
Investment in our rural economy must focus heavily on rewarding our farmers for the food they produce and for the environment that they protect. The last government ring-fenced £2.4 billion a year for England to support our farming sector. Through indifference or incompetence, they underspent by £100 million last year and betrayed our farmers in doing so. Will she confirm to me, to my farmers and to this House, that she will not bake in that underspend that was the fault of the last Conservative government and will commit to at least ring-fencing what is already invested in farming?
Well, this is Rachel Reeves' reply.
The rural economy plays an incredibly important role in our economic prosperity as a country, and boosting food security and biodiversity is obviously incredibly important to a whole range of this government's objectives. I will ensure that the Secretary of State for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs hears loud and clear the message from the Right Honourable Member, and will ensure that I'm sure that he will include that as part of his submission to the spending review on the 30th of October.
So, how significant would a cut of £100 million be to the DEFRA budget? Sue Pritchard is Chief Executive of the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission. She told Anna it would have considerable impact.
It is a substantial sum of money when we understand how big our ask is of farmers and the food system to provide for some of the most, you know, crucial elements of our economy. Food is foundational to our economy. Farming is foundational to the food system. And so it is a big sum of money when we put it in the context of exactly what we're asking from farmers and the food system.
Is it actually possible, though, that if the government does decide to cut the budget by this £100 million, it might actually be a cut even bigger than that?
Well, that's right. We have heard signals from the Chancellor, from the Prime Minister,
about the economic challenges that they're dealing with. And I think it probably would have been naive of us not to recognise that we, as a sector, were going to be asked to lean into that challenge.
Do we know why there was an underspend?
Farmers have not been clear and confident about the direction of travel for English farming. Take-up has been slow. The options available have been piecemeal. It's been pretty complicated, even for those really, really committed farmers who are focused on, you know, maximising payments, to understand how they can, you know, weave those payments together to support the kind of farming that they want to do. But I think DEFRA has been working really hard with farmers to understand how to improve take-up, and they were certainly on an upward trajectory.
Some people might argue that if farmers didn't apply for some of these environmental schemes, and that's why the underspend happened, then maybe the budget shouldn't be increased.
I think this is more about farmers having confidence in the direction of travel for UK agriculture, and recognising perhaps that a big transition like the one that we've been through, that we're still going through, actually takes time to bed down. Farmers, thankfully, are generally quite cautious and patient people in how they change their businesses. And so they need, I think, several things to all come together. They need a clear version of the future that UK government is really standing behind. And that's not just, you know, a DEFRA strategy. It's a trade strategy. It's a business strategy. It's a land use strategy. It's a health strategy too. The role of, you know, farmers and food producers in improving the health of the UK. And then for Treasury to really get behind the task of understanding where is all the money in the system. This isn't just about public money. It's about how supply chains currently support the transition that we know that farmers need to make.
There were many, many calls on DEFRA from various parts of farming asking for that budget, the DEFRA budget, to be increased, not decreased. What do you think is going to happen on October the 30th?
Well, I think DEFRA is going to be subject to exactly the same pressures as the other government departments. One of the challenges for DEFRA is that it's not central at the moment to the government mission boards. I think DEFRA really needs to work hard to make the case for how, in lots of ways, it is central to the delivery of the other government missions. But I think the opportunity remains for DEFRA working with Treasury to get a really clear sense of what is the strategic plan for agriculture, what is the resource that's needed, and where does that resource have to come from? Is it just the public purse, or are there other actors in the system who can play their part in resourcing that transition?
Sue Pritchard from the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission talking to Anna Hill. That's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer was Beatrice Fenton, and Farming Today is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
And of course, Farming Today is here on Radio 4 each weekday morning at 6:15. Later on this morning, Greg Jenner will be heading back to the 11th century to hear about the legendary Viking explorer Leif Erikson, who might just have been the first European to reach the Americas nearly half a millennium before Christopher Columbus landed in the Caribbean. That's in You're Dead to Me at 10 o'clock. Now, though, with an update on the weather, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Alan. Good morning. We saw the warmest day of the year so far for Northern Ireland yesterday. Temperatures got up to 27 Celsius there, as they did across parts of Western Scotland. We saw 28 in Cambridge too, so we've still got that warm air mass with us today, but it won't be quite as warm as it was yesterday. And thankfully, we've lost the really heavy, persistent rain that's been causing flash flooding across parts of South Wales and Southern England over recent days. So a quieter day, but still a day of contrast. Now, we start off across all of southern England, Wales, the Midlands and eastern England with some mist and some fog patches around. So a little bit murky at first thing this morning. Most of that mist and fog will tend to break up, lifting into low cloud, but some areas will keep the cloud through the course of the day. A lot of dry weather, a few sunny spells for parts of southeast England, central Wales, for instance, as well. But there'll also be some showers around, and they're most likely for, I think, the south coast of Cornwall, Devon, for instance, into parts of the Midlands. South Wales could see a shower, one or two towards Lincolnshire as well. But many places will stay dry, and temperatures across this region between about 20 to 24 degrees today. For northeast England and eastern Scotland, well, here we've got more extensive mist, low cloud and fog. It's going to generally burn back towards the coast, so things are going to brighten up, should be largely dry out there. But if you're close to that east coast, you may just keep some lingering sea fog through the day. Top temperatures between about 18 to 22. For northwest England, southwest Scotland, northern Scotland and Northern Ireland, though, after any morning mistiness clears, it is going to be a lovely day. Light winds, long spells of blue sky and sunshine, lifting temperatures to 24 or 25. Now, into this evening and tonight, we're going to see some heavy, potentially thundery showers moving into southern England at first, and then they'll become more extensive across England and Wales by the end of the night. Tomorrow, we're going to see more of those heavy showers and some thunderstorms across England and Wales, but it looks like another settled and fine day to come tomorrow for Scotland and for Northern Ireland too.
Thank you, Sarah. The Today programme is next.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and as America prepares for another presidential election, we've got a new series of The Coming Storm. We're investigating how a vast conspiracy movement has gripped the United States.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
We demand the truth.
In this world, hidden hands control events, and nothing is as it seems.
You believe that U.S. intelligence was involved in this cover-up somehow?
I do. And I'm not quite sure why.
The Coming Storm, starting this Wednesday morning at 9:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 7th of September. This is Today with Sean Farrington in Salford and Michelle Hussain in London.
The headlines this morning: Donald Trump has welcomed a judge's decision that he won't be sentenced over his hush money conviction until after the presidential election in November. The faulty spacecraft, the Starliner, which left two astronauts stranded on the International Space Station, has returned to Earth without them.
Also in today's programme, several former judges want prison sentences to be shortened. We're going to be speaking to the former Justice Secretary, Alex Chalk. And after election success for the far-right AfD party in Germany, we'll hear from voters in Brandenburg, the next area of the country to vote.
It is always reported that half of the people voted for the AfD, but half of the people here did not vote for them. So it is not everyone, and many people also don't vote at all.
And
it's youth against experience. Gauguin comes again. What has Sarah Story got left? Has she done it? She has! Oh, what a story!
Dame Sarah Story and Claire Balding will be joining us to reflect on this year's Paralympics as they draw to a close.
I'm Delith Lloyd with the rest of your Saturday sport as Britain's Jack Draper's run in New York ends in defeat in the semi-finals of the US Open.
The BBC News this morning is read by Alan Smith.
Donald Trump has said his conviction in his hush money trial should be terminated after a judge in New York delayed sentencing until after November's presidential election. The case relates to a payment to an adult film star just before Mr. Trump's victory in 2016. A prominent Republican, Dick Cheney, has described him as a threat to democracy and said he would vote for the Democratic Party's candidate, Kamala Harris. Our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes, reports.
Donald Trump was found guilty of falsifying business records to conceal a payment he made to Stormy Daniels and could be sent to prison for up to 4 years. The judge said the delay in sentencing was necessary to avoid any appearance, however unwarranted, that the proceeding had been affected by or sought to affect the presidential election. While the delay was welcome news for the Republican candidate, his campaign has suffered a setback. The former Republican Vice President Dick Cheney has confirmed he'll be voting for Kamala Harris in November because, as he put it, Donald Trump could never be trusted with power again after trying to steal the last election using lies and violence. Mr. Trump has dismissed him as irrelevant and a Republican in name only.
Sir Keir Starmer will travel to Washington next Friday for talks with President Biden. It's the Prime Minister's second visit since winning the election and his first since Vice President Harris replaced Mr. Biden as the Democrats' presidential nominee. A statement from the White House said the leaders would discuss a range of global issues, including their continued support for Ukraine. The England football manager, Lee Carsley, has suggested he will not sing the national anthem when his side lined up for his match in charge against Republic of Ireland in Dublin this evening. The former Irish international, who replaced Gareth Southgate this summer, says it'll be a proud moment, but singing might distract his focus. Our correspondent Chichi Izundu has more.
Gareth Southgate, who stood down in July, was an enthusiastic singer of the national anthem before matches. But his replacement, Lee Carsley, says that's never been his style, either when he was playing for the Irish Republic or as a coach for the England under-21s. Speaking to the BBC, he said he respected anthems but needed to concentrate on the game ahead.
I've never sung the national anthem for Ireland as I want for England. So, and that's just because of my own personal match preparation. I'm fully focused on the game. It was something that when I was playing for Ireland, I always struggled with the wait between warming up, going back into the dressing room, the walk in the tunnel, and then the wait while the anthems were on.
Carsley was born in Birmingham, but qualified for Ireland through his grandmother and played 40 times for the Republic. Earlier this summer, he turned down an approach to be their new manager and is hoping to take permanent charge of England. But his reluctance to sing God Save the King has already gone down badly with the press and may risk angering his own supporters.
Sir Keir Starmer will be at England's match tonight as part of a visit to Dublin for talks with the Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris. Sir Keir said he wanted the UK's relationship with Ireland to reach its full potential. Mr. Harris called it an important moment of reset. The government is expected to introduce legislation next week to ban landlords in England from evicting tenants without a reason. The Renters' Rights Bill would also extend social housing safety rules to the private sector. More details from our political correspondent Leila Nathu.
A ban on no-fault evictions has long been promised but has been repeatedly delayed. The previous Conservative Housing Secretary Michael Gove had tried to take a renters' reform bill through Parliament but ran out of time before the general election was called. Now it's expected the Labour government will introduce its version into the Commons for the first time next week. It's understood that ministers would seek to enact the ban on Section 21 evictions immediately after the bill became law, rather than waiting for reforms to the court system as the previous government had proposed. Other provisions in the bill would seek to give greater rights to challenge rent increases and to apply what's known as Awab's Law to the private sector, requiring landlords to fix hazards within a certain time frame. It's named after two-year-old Awab Ishak, who died as a result of exposure to mould in his family's home in Rochdale in 2020.
Boeing's Starliner spacecraft has returned to Earth, but without the astronauts it was supposed to be carrying. The capsule suffered several technical problems during its test flight to the International Space Station, and NASA decided it was too risky to bring the crew home. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, watched the landing.
Touchdown. Starliner is back on Earth.
This was the moment Boeing's Starliner spacecraft returned to Earth. After a six-hour journey, it opened three large parachutes to slow its descent before landing in the desert of New Mexico. But instead of having NASA's Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams on board, the capsule was empty. The astronauts had watched it undock and depart from the International Space Station, where they'll now remain. They're waiting to return home with rival company SpaceX, but not until February next year, extending what was supposed to be an eight-day mission to 8 months. Now Starliner's back, both Boeing and NASA will be poring over data from the spacecraft. They'll need to fix the multiple technical problems that plagued this test mission if the spacecraft is to fly again.
A section of the M62 motorway is completely closed this weekend between Manchester and Leeds to allow Network Rail to replace an ageing bridge near Rochdale. Drivers looking to cross the Pennines are being advised to use alternative routes. In tennis, the British men's number one Jack Draper has lost his US Open semi-final in straight sets. The 22-year-old said he'd done all he could against the world number one Jannik Sinner, but admitted that nerves had got the better of him. Our sports reporter Russell Fuller was watching.
Jack Draper came within 2 points of winning the first set, but started to struggle physically in a dramatic second set on a humid New York afternoon. He was sick at least twice, and when Sinner fell heavily on his left wrist, there was the rare sight of one player being treated by the physio and the other by the doctor. It was only in the last four games of the match that Draper's resistance faded, and he admitted afterwards that the stress of playing such an important match had made him nauseous. The 22-year-old's run to the last four in New York has catapulted him into the top 20 in the world. But success means little rest. And Draper says he is still expecting to be able to represent Great Britain in next week's Davis Cup Finals team competition in Manchester.
And the celebrated Brazilian musician Sergio Mendes, who brought bossa nova to global audiences in the 1960s, has died at his home in Los Angeles. He was 83. His family said he'd been suffering from the effects of long COVID. A talented pianist and composer, Sergio Mendes was credited with popularising Brazilian music in the United States, where he toured with Frank Sinatra. His biggest hit was his rendition of Mascanada in 1966. The music of Sergio Mendes, who's died.
Thanks, Alan. What an iconic bit of music. Right, let's have a look at what headlines are making a few of the front pages inside the papers this morning. The Times laying out what will be a bit of a challenge for the government to answer over the coming months. Rich ready to quit UK over budget tax threat. So the Times have been speaking to a few tax partners at various auditing companies around the country who say that they're seeing a surge of inquiries, says one, from wealthy Britons. Another saying, I've had calls from clients saying, if I don't get it done by October the 30th, this could affect my whole retirement planning because of various changes that may be on the horizon tax-wise. And another one for the government to give a bit more detail on in the weeks to come in the Sun. No fags at the nags, what a drag. Outdoor smoke ban to hit racing potentially could be next on the horizon. We've had the debate about beer gardens. Will it happen there? Could it be race courses as well?
The Guardian reports on its front page and inside about the American woman who has been shot dead in the West Bank, a 26-year-old woman. Witnesses said the US citizen had been shot at by Israeli soldiers positioned in a field in Beita near Nablus after minor clashes broke out. They said troops surrounded a group of praying people and Palestinians began to throw stones, to which the soldiers responded with tear gas and live ammunition. The Israel Defense Forces said they were looking into the report that troops had killed a foreign national while firing at an instigator of violent activity. But the White House has said it was deeply disturbed by the killing of 26-year-old Aishano Ezgi Egi and was seeking an Israeli investigation. The Guardian gives some wider context about the protest activity that the woman was involved with. All Israeli settlements in the West Bank are considered illegal under international law. But she was protesting around a place called Eviata, which was partly constructed on land seized from Beita in 2013. It was not built with Israeli government permission, therefore considered an outpost. Its future has been subject to legal wrangling by the Israeli courts for years, sparking regular high-profile protests from both Palestinians and settlers. And then it was among several legalised by the Israeli cabinet last month, including protests when people, including far-right members of the Israeli government, marched in support of that legalisation.
And that story we heard about in the news headlines, making the front page of the Daily Telegraph, the splash there, England manager, I won't sing our anthem. And the interim manager of the England football team, Lee Carsley, suggesting he won't sing the national anthem today. The chief football correspondent at the Telegraph saying he can't expect to get the job full time if he doesn't sing it at all. So all eyes on the footy. But they'll be watching the anthems closely before the game as well.
And just a mention of something on the front page of the Financial Times. If you're having a croissant this morning, maybe even an expensive one at a cafe somewhere, can you be sure that it wasn't frozen? Frozen croissants apparently on the rise as unwitting coffee shop customers eat record volumes of pre-made groups, and often cafes would not admit to the fact that they're buying in frozen products. The March of Industrial Croissants is the latest example of small-scale artisanal craft being squeezed out by mass production to improve cost efficiency and cope with shortages of specialised labour, in this case bakers, the FT says. But there was a report in the French newspaper Le Parisien recently, it says, about a high-end pastry chef who conducted a blind tasting and picked a croissant baked from frozen as the top product out of three.
Would you care, Michelle, if it was from frozen oranges?
I would not. There's absolutely nothing wrong with frozen food, unless it's passed off as something else.
The magic of pastry as well is you warm it up and it just tastes Michelin star, I'll find, whatever the pastry might be. Anyway, that's the extent of my culinary skills. Let's move back on to
some of the challenges Sir Keir Starmer will have in the days ahead. Some of the visits he's going to be making as well. Visiting Ireland today, as we've heard, the first by a British Prime Minister for 5 years, meeting the Taoiseach Simon Harris before they head along to that game, the Republic of Ireland and England in the Nations League. And then, towards the end of next week, Sir Keir will be heading to the US for the second time in a couple of months to meet President Biden. Georgia Roberts is our political reporter. Morning, Georgia.
Morning.
What's he aiming for in these visits?
Well, a new era of friendship is what this trip to Dublin is being billed as today after some trickiness seen during the Brexit negotiations. Keir Starmer, though, has been on quite a busy charm offensive with European leaders recently to try and reset relations. But next week's trip to see President Biden will be interesting. It's the second time the two will meet since Keir Starmer took office. Last time it was on the margins of the NATO summit. It'll be the first time the two will speak face-to-face after President Biden announced he would not seek the Democratic nomination for the election in November. You might recall Keir Starmer slightly awkwardly having to field questions mostly on the president's mental fitness during the last visit rather than the issues. But this time the issues will very much be on the table, not least the UK's decision to suspend some export licences to Israel after a review found possible breaches of international law. Keir Starmer said this decision was underpinned by clear legal framework. President Biden's team has said they respected the decision, but it's an unusual differing of policy on the conflict between the two. So Labour, since taking power, have also changed the UK's stance on arrest warrants against Israeli leaders and restored funding to the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees that the Conservatives, when they were in power, chose not to do because of allegations by Israel that some of its staff were involved with the October 7th attack. So a series of policy decisions taken on this major conflict that have diverged somewhat from the US. Plenty to talk about.
Between those two trips, Georgia, it may well be, well, there will be a fair few questions asked about winter fuel payments. Once again, after eight this morning, we're going to be focusing on that. How much more difficult has this issue, the cuts for millions of pensioners, got for the government now that trade unions are becoming more vocal about reversing that decision?
That's right, and it'll all potentially be laid out in the open next week. Labour had previously said they wouldn't hold a vote on the decision to cut winter fuel payments for all but the poorest pensioners, but pressure's been building, as you say. Now they're holding a vote. We've heard concerns from some on the Labour benches. We also, as you say, have some unions expressing concern. We could well hear more when the TUC conference gets underway next week. But just on this vote, because a lot of eyes will be on it, Labour will win this. There's safety in numbers for now, but this is about looking for the scale and the depth of the unhappiness and the potential sanctions for rebelling. Will the whip be stripped from anybody who goes against the leadership? Certainly what I think reflects the widest held mood at the moment in the Labour backbenches. I was hearing from one newly elected Labour MP yesterday in a rural seat with a high population of pensioners who will be spending a lot of money heating their homes this winter. And he was saying to me, look, I'm deeply uncomfortable with this policy. I was elected to stand up for the poorest, but I've also just got here and I'm not prepared to be given the boot from the party when there's going to be far more difficult decisions, far more difficult days like this ahead.
Georgia, thank you. Georgia Roberts, our political reporter.
16 minutes past seven. Donald Trump's sentencing over paying hush money to Stormy Daniels will not now happen before November's presidential election, a judge in New York has decided, accepting a request from the Republican nominee and his lawyers. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
The judge said the delay in sentencing was necessary to, just to quote him, to avoid any appearance, however unwarranted, that the proceeding has been affected or seeks to affect the approaching presidential election in which the defendant is a candidate. So essentially what he's doing is ensuring that he is absolutely fair in not having this sentencing during the crucial build-up to the election, which will be the next couple of months. So it has been delayed to just after the election, the 26th of November. So we now face the prospect, or Donald Trump faces the prospect, of either being the president-elect at that time or the defeated candidate on the day that he is sentenced.
So had it not been for this decision of the judge, he could have been in jail in the run-up to the election or on the election date, because a jail sentence was possible in this case?
In theory, yes, because he could get up to 4 years in prison for these offences, or a lesser sentence of a fine and or probation. Just to remind you, he was convicted in the so-called hush money trial, 34 counts of falsifying
business records. They related to the payment of $130,000 to Stormy Daniels, the former adult film star. The prosecution said that was a payment to buy her silence, and she told the court that they had sex and she accepted the money before the 2016 election to keep quiet about it.
Was there any impact on this decision of the judge from the recent Supreme Court ruling?
That is to be decided, and the judge will hold a hearing after the election but before the sentencing to determine just that question, whether he believes that the Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity has any impact on this case. Now, clearly, President Trump's lawyers will be arguing that it does, although I think we should really stress that that ruling seems to apply mostly to the January the 6th case and Donald Trump's actions in the days before January the 6th and in terms of what his supporters did on that day and the argument over whether he was acting in an official capacity or not and whether it has any relevance on that case.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
Getting more reaction on that story after 8 o'clock as well. It's just 19 minutes past seven for the moment. There were calls for new regulations to improve the safety of lithium-ion batteries yesterday in Parliament. The attempt to change the law comes after a number of e-bike and e-scooter fires, but the government told the House of Lords it was bringing forward its own plans to tackle the problem. Here's our correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
Last year, 30-year-old Scott Pedden woke from a coma to find that his life had been destroyed by an e-bike fire. His partner Gemma, their two young children and the family's dogs had been killed in a blaze at their Cambridge home. In a debate on a bill to improve the safety around lithium-ion batteries, peers heard that this was far from an isolated incident, with estimates that in London alone there was an e-bike or e-scooter fire every 2 days. A Liberal Democrat, Lord Reedsdale, said the vast majority of the batteries were safe, but problems were caused by poor quality batteries and chargers. He said lithium-ion battery fires could burn at more than 600 degrees Celsius and release toxic gases.
Once on fire, lithium-ion battery fires are almost impossible to extinguish with traditional firefighting methods, as the battery creates its own oxygen. Whilst the risk of fire is low, the way people charge their e-bikes and scooters mean that these fires can be particularly dangerous. Many devices are charged in halls or stairwells, and often overnight, which is one of the reasons for the number of deaths associated with the fires at home.
So he was putting forward a bill to improve safety around standards, online sales and disposal. A crossbench or independent peer, Lady Finlay, said people on low incomes were more likely to use e-bikes, and she highlighted a particular risk.
People can modify bikes to e-bikes with a conversion kit, and these kits involve sourcing a battery and a charger separately, which may not reach correct safety standards, and the batteries are then more susceptible to catastrophic failure when the incorrect charge is used.
A Lib Dem, Lady Brinton, is vice chair of the all-party fire safety group. She raised the case of Scott Pedden's family and told peers an inquest had been opened into their deaths.
He has demanded tougher regulations for such devices. He had no idea of the dangers in the item that he bought online. Cambridgeshire Fire Services wrote to the coroner to ask for better regulation of online sales in e-bike batteries.
For the Conservatives, Lord Camrose said there was a global market for lithium-ion batteries and he hoped the UK would play a significant role in the safe development of what he called a hugely important industry.
Without this industry, I don't believe we will realise our ambitions for electric vehicles, for renewable energy and storage, for tech innovation of all kinds.
He said his party supported the goals of the bill but had questions about how the proposed legislation would work. The Science Minister, Lady Jones, said the government recognised the importance of safe storage, use and disposal of lithium-ion batteries, but it had reservations about the bill. She said the government was already taking steps to deal with the issues raised by Lord Reedsdale.
Our efforts have led to 18 separate product recalls and 20 other enforcement actions for unsafe or non-compliant e-bikes or e-scooters since 2022.
She said the government had introduced its own legislation earlier in the week and urged Lord Reedsdale to withdraw his proposals. But he pressed on and his bill was given a second reading without a vote. It will now go off for further scrutiny.
That was Alicia McCarthy reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. It is now 23 minutes past seven. Scientific research led by academics based in the UK can once again access EU Horizon funding. That decision was announced a year ago after a post-Brexit arrangement was reached. Now the first 50 projects to gain funding have been announced. So let's hear about two of them. One is about what happens when black holes tear stars apart. Dr. Clément Bonnereau is assistant professor in astrophysics at the University of Birmingham. He'll talk about that in a moment. And the other involves work on the gut microbiome with Evangelos Giampazzolia from the Cancer Immunosurveillance Group at the University of Manchester. If you go first, Dr. Giampazzolia, how should we understand your work?
Yeah, hello everyone. We are really in an era of revolution in the way we treat cancer, because more and more cancer patients are treated with a type of a therapy called immunotherapy. So unlike chemotherapy and radiotherapy, immunotherapy really boosts our own natural defense, the immune system, to fight cancer. Although this is remarkable, still there is a significant portion of patients that are not responding to those therapies. So my research is really to understand why certain patients are responding to immunotherapy and why some others they don't. And the main issue for this is because in certain cases, the immune system is not very good in detecting cancer as a problem. So we try to understand what makes cancer a visible threat to our immune system. And really coming to the microbiome, as you mentioned, there is a lot of interest these days in understanding that there is this anecdotal finding that our friendly microbes that live in our gut, called microbiome, can somehow influence the ability of the immune system to detect cancer as a threat and allow it to basically attack it. So what we try to understand in my lab is really the relationship between how these friendly microbes that are important to our physiology really tells the immune system that here is cancer, this is the problem, please go and eliminate it.
I can see why it's incredibly important to get to the answers of some of those questions. Is this funding that you would not have been able to access before this?
It's an incredible honor of being funded by the ERC, because basically this complements my funding from Cancer Research UK and basically allows me to interact with scientists across the globe, basically in Europe, and try to join forces in understanding this very interesting biological phenomena. If we are able to understand this, we will be able to pave the way to new treatments in coupling smart strategies in boosting the immune system to fight cancer.
Well, let's also hear from the astrophysicist, Dr. Clément Bonnereau, who's on the line. Was this the right simple way to explain the area of your research, that it is about what happens when black holes tear stars apart?
That's completely correct. So my research is very different. I'm an astrophysicist and I study black holes, especially the most massive ones called supermassive black holes that lie at the center of all galaxies, including our own galaxy, the Milky Way. And indeed, when a star gets too close to such a black hole, the gravity gets so intense that the star gets completely torn apart. And this leads to the emission of a powerful flash of light that we can actually detect using our telescopes on Earth. So my research will focus on theoretically understanding these events to be able to better use observations in the future to learn about different mysteries surrounding these supermassive black holes.
Do you have the images already? Is this about the analysis of them, or will some of this funding go towards getting better images?
So the goal of my research is entirely theoretical. So the goal is to understand how these extreme events happen, and this will be done using computer simulations, and these simulations in turn will be used to better analyze the observations to be made in the future. Okay.
And in your case as well, would any access to this EU Horizon funding only have been possible before this this decision, if you were in collaboration with researchers based in the EU?
So yeah, since Brexit, it was not possible for UK researchers to access such large-scale grants. So I think it's great news that the UK has rejoined The Horizon program will make the country more attractive for international researchers such as me, especially at the early career stage. So I think it's great news.
Well, best of luck with your research, Dr. Clément Bonnereau, and also to Evangelos Giampazolia. Thank you both.
It's 28 minutes past seven. Let's catch up with Delith Lloyd now with the sports news. Delith, join me in the studio. Delith, just before we went to bed last night, sort of saw Jack Draper putting up a real fight.
Gosh,
in the US Open semi-final.
It was absolutely fantastic. What a performance from Jack Draper. He gave it all. He left everything out on the court, Sean. But his run at the US Open is over after he lost in the semi-final to world number one Jannik Sinner in straight sets. Draper was beaten in, well, a grueling contest really at Flushing Meadows, which saw him vomit on court. The 22-year-old was the first British man in the last four at the US Open since Andy Murray won the title in 2012. Tennis correspondent Russell Fuller reflects on a dramatic contest in New York.
After a cool second week, this was a more humid afternoon, and both players struggled physically at times. Draper came within 2 points of winning the first set, but three double faults at five games all proved decisive. In the second set, he was sick at least twice, and when Sinner fell heavily on his left wrist, there was the rare and bizarre sight of one player being treated by the physio and the other by the doctor. Sinner won the set on a tiebreak, and in the third set, Draper's resistance did finally start to fade. The 22-year-old says the stress and anxiety of playing such an important match had made him nauseous, an issue he has experienced before in Grand Slam matches.
It's been important for me to sort of be calm over time. I think I'm doing a better job of that, and I'm seeing that I'm doing a better job of that. But, you know, sometimes, you know, it's still something that I'm working on and working through. I don't think that's abnormal, you know, for players to go through, especially when they're young in their career and on the biggest stages. You know, we've seen that with many players, so I think over time it will definitely improve.
Is there anything more you can do? Do you feel as if you're on the right path?
Yeah, there's nothing more I can do. Honestly, I probably look back at the match and sort of see myself struggling a bit, but I know in the moment when I was out there I couldn't do any more. You know, I was fighting to give everything. I'm just not quite there yet, you know. In terms of my training and what I'm doing on a day-to-day, I can't ask any more of myself. I've got great people around me. I'm doing all the right things. I'm trying to get to that position where I'm going to be a top player in the world, and that's my goal, and all the experiences I just take them in my stride.
And how do you view the 2 weeks as a whole?
Yeah, I'm very, very proud, obviously. Tough to come unstuck today. But, you know, I think when I look back and I reflect on where I was last year and the sort of the thoughts and feelings I had when I was injured and not being able to play and dropping outside the top 100 in the world, coming here, and I'm leaving this tournament this year, you know, having made Grand Slam semi and be top 20 in the world from next week, I think, you know, I can't ask any more of myself. So very proud, but also at the same time, you know, I'm a competitor and I want to keep on doing better.
This is the final Grand Slam of the year, but Draper still has high hopes of British success in the Davis Cup team competition. The group stage of the finals takes place in Manchester next week. Britain's first tie is against Finland on Wednesday. It's a quick turnaround, but Draper says he hopes and expects to be there. Success is wonderful, but it leaves little time for rest.
With 2 days of competition left in Paris, Paralympics GB have already eclipsed the number of gold medals won in Tokyo. That tally now stands at 42. Swimmer Poppy Maskell claimed her third gold of the Games in the women's S14 100 metres backstroke. Craig Bellamy's first match in charge of Wales ended goalless against 10-man Turkey in Cardiff. But there was plenty of exciting football on display, and Bellamy says the performance from his players was outstanding.
Believe me, this is the worst we're going to be. The more we learn, the more we spend time together, the finer details, I believe there's so much more. And it's such a good start, but there's way more to come from this team.
We'll reflect more on this in an hour's time and look ahead to a new era for England. But interim manager Lee Carsley says he won't be singing the national anthem ahead of their Nations League match against Republic of Ireland this evening.
When I was playing for Ireland, I always struggled with the weight between warming up, going back into the dressing room, the walk in the tunnel, and then the wait while the anthems were on. It's because usually in the Premier League it was quite quick. So, yeah, it's been no different when I've been coaching England under 21s. It's really in that zone and preparing for the game.
Finally, Ollie Pope will resume on 103, with England 221 for 3 against Sri Lanka on day 2 of the third test at the Oval.
Thanks, Delith. It is 33 minutes past seven. Broadcasting House will be here tomorrow, so it's only right that we hear from Paddy.
Hello, the Health Secretary will join us live ahead of an independent review of the NHS. Three listeners who gave up their smartphone for a dumb one are back to report on the impact on their life and mental health. Stonehenge is overrated and boring, say lovers of myriad other ancient stones around the UK. We go in praise of the mini-henge. And amid the British apple harvest, we audit the shelves. Can you find homegrown favourites near you? BH at bbc.co.uk, on BBC Sounds and on air here on Radio 4 tomorrow morning at 9.
Let's have a look at the weather now. Cloudy towards the south with showery but drier and sunnier for many further north. So cloudy towards the south with showers. I think that should be. The time is still 7:33. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Sean Farrington. And now a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Donald Trump has said his conviction in his hush money trial should be terminated after a judge in New York put off his sentencing until after November's presidential election. The judge said the delay was to maintain fairness during the campaign. The lifelong Republican and former US Vice President Dick Cheney has announced that he will support the Democratic candidate Kamala Harris in November's election. Keir Starmer will travel to Washington next Friday for talks with President Biden. It's the Prime Minister's second visit since winning the election and his first since Vice President Harris replaced Mr. Biden as the Democrats' nominee. A statement from the White House said the leaders would discuss a range of global issues, including their continued support for Ukraine. Keir is visiting Dublin today for talks with the Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris. Ahead of the trip, Keir said he wanted the UK's relationship with Ireland to reach its full potential. Mr. Harris called it an important moment of reset. Boris Johnson was the last British Prime Minister to visit Dublin 5 years ago. The government's expected to introduce legislation next week to ban landlords in England from evicting tenants without a reason. The Renters' Rights Bill also extends social housing safety rules to the private sector and looks to make it easier for renters to own pets. Boeing's Starliner spacecraft has returned to Earth, but without the astronauts it was supposed to be carrying. The capsule suffered several technical problems during its test flight to the International Space Station, and NASA decided it was too risky to bring the crew home. A section of the M62 motorway is completely closed this weekend. Junction 19 between Manchester and Leeds to allow Network Rail to replace an ageing bridge near Rochdale. Drivers looking to cross the Pennines are being advised to use alternative routes. And the Brazilian musician Sergio Mendes, who brought bossa nova to global audiences in the 1960s, has died aged 83. His family said he'd been suffering from the effects of long COVID.
Thanks, Alan. To Germany now, where the far-right Alternative for Deutschland has hopes of emerging as the strongest party in a second state in its eastern strongholds. Brandenburg, which surrounds Berlin, goes to the polls in 2 weeks' time. Our Germany correspondent Jessica Parker reports from a particular part of the state that's shown record-high backing for the AfD in a recent local council vote.
This is a southeastern corner of Brandenburg. There's a huge goose farm, a small church, and quiet country roads, tucked away within a state where the far-right Alternative for Deutschland could again win the most votes in an upcoming election. I've come to two villages, Jemlitz and Kleindüben. Why? Well, nearly 60% of people living here backed Alternative for Deutschland in a recent district council election. In Golf, a builder perches on some scaffolding. He grew up in what was the Communist German Democratic Republic, or GDR. An AfD supporter, he feels that since reunification, East Germans, Ossis, have been treated with disdain.
Do you think trust in the East, in these main parties, the established parties, is breaking down?
Ich denke schon.
I think so. Everyone complains about the GDR, but the government isn't much better now, and the school system's become really bad. I went to school in the GDR. It was an example for many countries.
Immigration and Berlin's divided government are also recurring themes of discontent. You couldn't exactly say it's election fever around here, but there are a few placards up, stuck to lampposts on the roadside, including one from Alternative für Deutschland. It reads, Es ist Zeit für Frieden. It's time for peace. And the AfD's call to stop sending weapons to Ukraine does appeal to people we're speaking to here. Nearby, we meet Yvonne. While sympathetic to the AfD, she's leaning towards the surging force that is the Sarah Wagenknecht Alliance. With its brand of left-wing conservatism, the party also wants to end arms supplies to Kyiv.
The money for Ukraine is an issue. War is never good. Everyone knows that. And this is our tax money that is sent abroad.
Don't you worry about Russia winning a war in a country they invaded?
Der Krieg ist, ich finde Krieg sowieso eigentlich, sag mal auf Deutsch, sinnlos. Also,
I think war in general is senseless. I can understand both sides, but I don't want the war. And it is not far away. Poland is not big, and we are then the first ones to go when the tanks come across.
Children splash in a lake not far from the village, where a woman called Katrin agrees to talk to us if we move away from the crowd. You get the feeling she's got something controversial to say.
Ich bin nur erschüttert.
She's anti-AfD, what can around here feel like a rogue opinion.
I am just devastated. It is always reported that half of the people voted for the AfD. But half of the people here did not vote for them. So it is not everyone, and many people also don't vote at all.
Why do you think the AfD is so popular around here?
Das ist eine gute Frage. Das frage ich mich die ganze Zeit.
This is a good question. This is what I ask myself all the time. There is this old saying, if a donkey is too comfortable, it goes on black ice. I cannot answer these questions about why. I'm lost for words. Help!
Katrin is saying she thinks life is actually relatively good for people here, and it is an idyllic scene. In this state, as elsewhere, even if the AfD does well, they likely won't take power because no one will work with them. It's a party viewed by many as right-wing extremist, even officially classed as such by some state authorities. Nevertheless, Brandenburg may deliver the next shock in German politics within weeks. What isn't clear is whether these shifting sands are largely built on a protest vote or something more permanent.
Jessica Parker reporting there, and listening to that was Anne Applebaum, historian and author, whose latest book, Autocracy, Inc., looks at efforts by autocratic states to undermine democracy. Anne, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Just as we heard in Jessica's piece there, the anti-Ukraine comments we heard. Why do you think Germany's support for Ukraine has become such an issue?
So it's not an issue everywhere, but there has been a consistent decade-long Russian-backed campaign to convince especially East Germans, but also Russian-speaking Germans, of whom there are several million, not to trust NATO, not to admire the transatlantic alliance, to listen to Russia, to follow Russian media or Russian-backed media. And it's finally having an effect. I worked on a project that looked at this back in 2017. It was very hard to get mainstream German parties to pay attention. They were very complacent. But the AfD has deep Russian links, and it's used those to promote those ideas.
And the ideas, you know, the positive comments we hear about the olden days, is it, you know, looking to the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, how important is that history in these particular elections?
I'm sure it's a part of it. But, you know, if you look at any part of the world where people feel left out of the mainstream, where they feel uncomfortable with modernity, where things have been changing too fast, economic, demographic, social, informational change has impacted them, you will find nostalgia. And people are nostalgic for what they remember as maybe a simpler time. It was the time of their childhood, the time of their adolescence. You can find it in Britain. You can find it in America. You can find it everywhere. And it is completely unsurprising that you find it in East Germany, too. And of course, that in the case of East Germany, it comes with a memory of Russia as a kind of, you know, a big brother, you know, friendly country who helped us.
I wanted to bring in Oliver Moody, who's the Berlin correspondent for The Times and The Sunday Times. Morning, Oliver.
Good morning.
Who do you see as voting for the AfD and why?
Well, the data from the last two state elections in Thuringia and Saxony is fascinating. It's really challenged the classic stereotype of who votes for the AfD in Eastern Germany. And what they show is, first of all, that a majority of AfD voters are no longer primarily motivated by protest against the establishment. They actually like what the party has to say. And the second insight is that the party is now strongest among Generation Z, the under 25s in particular, followed by millennials, and weakest among the over 70s. So this idea that the party is trading on GDR nostalgia, I think, really needs to be revisited. It is the dominant party of young people in Eastern Germany now.
And do you feel, you know, for all the work you've done on this kind of thing, that with the advent of social media, the power of the likes of TikTok and hearing how Gen Z and certain parts of the Gen Z demographic in Germany are thinking and acting right now, that things need to be re-looked at through a different lens?
Yeah, it took a long time to get, for example, the CDU, but also the other mainstream parties to even use Twitter or use TikTok or use those forms of social media. So, yeah, I mean, I think, if, you know, we may not like those forms of communication, or, you know, I have deep objections to TikTok. But if that's where young people are, then that's where politicians need to reach them. And I don't know that mainstream German politicians have been using those forms of communication. So it's unsurprising that they're not reaching younger people as well.
Do you expect much to change in the story to change much, Anne, in Germany in the weeks to come? You know, there's the big national election next year.
I mean, I can't predict the future, but certainly if the current trajectory continues, then there will be some parts of Germany. Remember, this is not the majority of Germans. It's still very much the minority. They do well in particular parts of the country, but the majority of Germans still support backing Ukraine, still support helping Ukraine win the war. And the majority of Germans still vote for mainstream parties. So it's not a threat to the nature of the state as of yet. But unless the mainstream parties find a way of reaching both younger people and older people in East Germany, yeah, it'll be a problem.
Anne Applebaum, Oliver Moody, thank you very much.
And the time is now 7:45.
So after a good 6 weeks of Olympians, Paralympians dominating our TVs and radio sets with their athletic prowess, tomorrow morning the general public gets a go alongside some of those world-class athletes live on the BBC as the 43rd Great North Run kicks off in Newcastle with a record 60,000 entries, making it the world's largest half marathon, created by Sir Brendan Foster all those years ago. It's actually 50 years ago to this day that Sir Brendan won his gold medal in the 1974 European Championship 5,000 metre final.
Brendan Foster, who now is 80 metres away from glory and the European Championship. Foster, the man who has led from gun to tape. Foster, the man now who comes home in 13 minutes, 16, 17. Foster, the gold medal for Britain. That was devastating.
Delighted to say Sir Brendan joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and what a delight to listen to my old friends, David Coleman, the late David Coleman, a fantastic friend in later years, and I worked with him at the BBC. But nice to hear that commentary. It was lovely.
And enough to inspire you to think about getting out there tomorrow morning, Sir Brendan?
I'll be there tomorrow morning, and I'll be running in spirit, but I won't be running. I'll be involved in the event itself, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's a big one.
It is a big one. 60,000 entries. You've talked before about, you know, what you've built here, but getting to the point of being the world's largest half marathon in the northeast of England, what does that mean tomorrow when this gets underway?
Well, I mean, when I look back, and you've just reminded me, but back in the day, there were only serious runners who went out running regularly and almost and ran every day. But nowadays, there are thousands and millions of people all around the world. Running's become a thing, and it's fantastic that we've organised an event like this, and we do our best to make it well organised. We do our best to welcome our entrants and our runners. But basically, it's the people who turn up. It's the supporters who on the roadside. We deliver the event, but they make it happen, and they make it what it is. And from day one, you know, in 1981, we had 12,000 runners turned up. And at the time, the biggest running event in Britain was the National Cross Country Championships in the 70s, and that was 1,300 runners. Suddenly, we saw 12,000, which made it the biggest event in the country. And it's been the same ever since. And 10 years ago, we received the plaque from the World Athletics Federation to be the first event to reach 1 million finishers, and we're now 1.3 million finishers. So,
and they're all incredible numbers, Sir Brendan, and it's an amazing advert for, you know, sport in the northeast of England. But does it tell the story of what's going on in the community sports sector, the funding outlook there at the moment?
Well, sadly, the funding of sport in the UK at the grassroots level, because of the cuts to local government, has been really seriously damaged over the years. And since COVID, it's been even worse. But out of that's come an action. And that these days, more people are running than ever before. And in fact, in our events, we're looking at the runners between the ages of 18 and 30. The young brigade are more and more. So the growth is biggest at the youth level. At the young level, and also with women. So there's an activity there which is dead easy to do. You don't need facilities. You just put your shoes on and go out the door. So I think the attraction is that it's easy to do. There's also an attraction, and there's something in the spirit of running together. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. At the grassroots level in this country, because of cuts over the years, sport at the grassroots level is in a poor way.
Sir Brendan Foster, former long-distance runner, of course, creator of the Great North Run. Thank you very much.
It is 10 to 8, and it is time for Thought for the Day. Our speaker this morning is the Reverend Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell, Welland, Garden City. Morning, Rob.
Good morning. There's been quite a debate in France following a decision to teach empathy to all children returning to school this term. Not everyone is convinced of its value. It's based on a model from Denmark. All children are now taught to recognise and respond to emotions in class and to ask others, how do you feel? Yesterday's big back-to-school assembly, streamed to over 500,000 pupils in the UK, covers similar areas. How to understand each other better and foster strong and inclusive values after the summer riots. As well as the sociological and kind of physiological aspects of empathy, there's also a spiritual dimension. Encouraging better human relations increases a sense of hope and well-being. The spirit is affected by both who we are and what we feel. For a Christian, any understanding of empathy starts with what's known as the incarnation. Divine empathy describes a moment in history when God is said to share fully in the human state, to share our human likeness, to know how we feel. If God in Jesus shared our humanity, the call for a believer is to reciprocate by how we treat each other. Now, Jesus's teaching throughout the Bible couldn't be clearer. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. And in every culture, this comes with inevitable hurdles and challenges. Think of that famous parable of the Good Samaritan, because in that story, told to prove Jesus's point, empathy is shown by the person who it was believed was least likely to respond. The very essence of the story is to encourage others to show their love of God by how they treat another person, regardless of a person's background, social standing or wealth. We do have a lot of work to do in this area in our own culture. What does empathy look like? How does that person really feel? You can see a modern parable of empathy in action on the BBC iPlayer right now. The final episode of Freddie Flintoff's Field of Dreams is wonderful. No spoilers, but it's a hugely emotional and thought-provoking programme. Freddie helps a group of lads who've had a tough start to life and uses cricket to make a difference. He helps them with their struggles. He wins them over. And what happens next reminds me of a verse from St. Peter's first letter. All of you, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble. For Freddie then suffers a traumatic, life-changing accident. and the roles are completely reversed. He's the one now needing confidence and encouragement, and they all reunite in very changed circumstances. It's a really poignant moment, because it's the lads who inspire Freddie now, and his ongoing physical healing is clearly enhanced by the true spirit of empathy that these young men naturally and spontaneously show. For those in any doubt about the value of encouraging mutual understanding in children, it's a startling example of its transformational healing power.
That was Rob Marshall with Thought for the Day at 7:07. The plans announced in July by the new government to ease overcrowding in prisons in England and Wales will take effect from Tuesday. They involve earlier release points and they come with the prison population at a record high. But what about the role of sentence inflation? In a new report for the Howard League for Penal Reform, five senior retired judges have said that the government must reverse the trend of locking people up for longer, pointing out that custodial sentences have doubled in length in the last 50 years. Let's turn to Alex Chalk KC, who was a Conservative MP and Secretary of State for Justice in the last government and held other ministerial roles before that. He lost his seat after the election back in July. Good morning, Mr. Chalk.
Good morning.
Are the judges right to say this?
They are. And I should just be clear that these judges are not, or retired judges, are not soft touches, you know, any more than I am. I've prosecuted people for murder, terrorism, manslaughter, serious sexual offence and so on. The fact is, there are some people who deserve very long sentences. You know, we think of the Wayne Cousins, Sarah Everard case, Levi Belfield and so on. But the fact is that overall sentences in Britain, in England and Wales anyway, are far, far longer than elsewhere in Europe. That is enormously expensive. And the critical point is it doesn't necessarily protect the public. So my strong view is that we should be locking up, including sometimes for longer, those that we're most scared of, but not necessarily everyone we're cross with.
Why didn't you act this way in government?
Well, we did. So one of the things in terms of the people we're most scared of, we ensured that those people would, there'd be more who would get what's known as whole life orders. In other words, life sentences without the opportunity of ever getting out. But there is no doubt, and this is something which is not really a political point across the piece, it is very difficult sometimes to say, look, we ought to be ensuring that actually the overall numbers coming into custody are not too great. So my
wait, that's a different point. That's a different point. I want to actually just understand fully this point about sentence lengths, because what you're saying suggests that you only really did that for the most serious offenders. But in fact, the Ministry of Justice figures show that average sentence lengths increased from 13.7 months in 2010 to 20.9 months in 2023. And if you look at the kinds of sentences, they increased considerably between 2010 and 2023 on a whole range of areas, whether it was robbery, whether it was drugs offences, fraud, criminal damage and arson, sexual offences, public order. In all of these areas, sentences became longer.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And so when I came into office, one of the things that I wanted to do was to bring in the presumption against short custodial sentences. In other words, if the court was minded to send someone to prison for less than 12 months, that there should be a presumption that that shouldn't take effect. And that was precisely for that sort of issue. But it's also worth reflecting that some of the most inflationary aspects of sentencing relate to things that were a long, long time ago. One thinks of that that dreadful case of the Ben Kinsella. Remember the Ben Kinsella knife crime case? That led, as indeed the judges said in their report, to sentencing for murder being massively, massively inflated and then things moving up in lockstep. A second example is IPPs. That relates to measures from 2003, David Blunkett's measures from 2003. So look, my feeling is we've got to proceed on the basis of evidence, not emotion. And I actually think the government is right to be having a sentencing review. Let's try to take the politics out of this and ensure that there is always the supply available to meet demand. And here's the one last point, is don't forget, locking people up is incredibly expensive. It costs about £50,000 a year. And the cost, the capital cost of each new place is around £600,000.
Yeah, so
of course,
I'm
locked
still
up for longer than the most serious ones, but not necessarily everyone will cross with.
I hear what you're saying, and you're out of government now, but if I compare it to what was in the manifesto of your party at this election, it is all about getting ever tougher. We will toughen sentences for knife crime, grooming gangs, assaults against retail workers. You know, it is all about the cracking down. It's not about reviewing in the way that you're setting out now.
Not so. So my argument was that, as I say, it's this point about scared of and cross with. So we were right, I think, to say that those who commit the most serious crimes, for example, rape. So when in 2010, every single rapist, or 99% of rapists, would be released automatically at the halfway point. Now, we took the view that actually, that's not right. That should be at the two-thirds mark. But to balance that, the view was those who are sentenced to the less serious matters, where they get an average of, say, 4 months if it's a sub-12-month sentence, that there should be a presumption against them going inside. That is a balanced package. Now, to govern is to choose. I absolutely accept the central premise of what the judges are saying, which is that things shouldn't always move up in lockstep. The balance to strike is those most serious offenders, okay, put them inside for longer, the rapists and the murderers, but not everyone else, to my mind. And because here's a really important point. If you get a short custodial sentence, you're 55% likely to commit an offence. But if that is, if you don't go inside, it's 25%.
Alex Chalk, we have to leave it there. Thanks.
Let's have a look at the weather now. Sarah Keith Lucas is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning.
Thanks, Sean. Well, we've got another day of contrast in the weather across the UK. Best of the sunshine today will be across western parts of Scotland, Northern Ireland, northwest England too. Further south and east, you've got more mist, low cloud and fog around this morning. So a bit of a misty, murky start for us. Largely that cloud will break up, but it'll linger longest across central and southern parts of England and Wales. There'll also be some outbreaks of rain in the southwest, also parts of South Wales into the Midlands. But sunny spells elsewhere, I think. Not quite as warm as it was yesterday. Temperatures for most of us somewhere between about 18 to 22 degrees, but we could see 24 or 25 once again across western Scotland and Northern Ireland.
I was shouting at the telly and he was just got so fed up and said, either do something about it or shut up. And I said, well, I will.
250 editions of Political Thinking are available now on BBC Sounds. And this weekend, the new series begins on Radio 4.
I was raised in a trade union family. Both my parents were active.
Personal insights from the people who shape our politics, including health workers, sports stars, musicians.
I was entitled to have an opinion, but I needed to justify it.
The new series of Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this evening at 5:30.
Good morning. It is 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 7th of September. This is Today with Sean Farrington in Salford and Michelle Hussain in London.
The headlines this morning, Sir Keir Starmer is visiting Dublin in what Downing Street is calling a new era of cooperation and friendship with the Irish Republic. The judge in Donald Trump's hush money trial has delayed sentencing until after the US presidential election to avoid claims of unfairness. We've been talking to Mike Murphy, the Republican strategist, who says he thinks it's bad news for Mr. Trump.
If the next 48 hours is Donald Trump angrily repeating every charge against him, doesn't help. He'd rather be on the offense ideologically against Kamala Harris.
Also in today's programme, Dame Sarah Story and Claire Balding will be joining us to reflect on this year's Paralympics as they draw to a close. We'll be speaking to the Labour MP who's planning a parliamentary bill on legalising assisted dying and...
Never to be forgotten, that first long secret drink of golden fire. Juice of those valleys and of that time.
The novels of Laurie Lee being set to music and performed across the country. We're going to be speaking to the Game of Thrones actor behind the project.
Good morning, I'm Delith Lloyd with your Saturday Sport. England interim manager Lee Carsley suggests he won't be singing the national anthem before kick-off tonight.
The BBC News this morning is read by Alan Smith.
Donald Trump has said his conviction in his hush money trial should be terminated after a judge in New York delayed sentencing until after November's presidential election. The case relates to a payment to an adult film star just before Mr. Trump's victory in 2016. A prominent Republican, Dick Cheney, has described him as a threat to democracy and said he would vote for the Democratic Party's candidate, Kamala Harris. Our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes, reports.
Donald Trump was found guilty of falsifying business records to conceal a payment he made to Stormy Daniels and could be sent to prison for up to 4 years. The judge said the delay in sentencing was necessary to avoid any appearance, however unwarranted, that the proceeding had been affected by or sought to affect the presidential election. While the delay was welcome news for the Republican candidate, his campaign has suffered a setback. The former Republican Vice President Dick Cheney has confirmed he'll be voting for Kamala Harris in November because, as he put it, Donald Trump could never be trusted with power again after trying to steal the last election using lies and violence. Mr. Trump has dismissed him as irrelevant and a Republican in name only.
Keir Starmer will travel to Washington next Friday for talks with President Biden. It's the Prime Minister's second visit since winning the election and his first since Vice President Harris replaced Mr. Biden as the Democrats' presidential nominee. A statement from the White House said the leaders would discuss a range of global issues, including their continued support for Ukraine. Sir Keir Starmer will travel to Dublin later for talks with the Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris. Sir Keir said he wanted the UK's relationship with Ireland to reach its full potential. Mr. Harris called it an important moment of reset. Here's our Ireland correspondent Chris Page.
Boris Johnson was the last British Prime Minister to visit Dublin 5 years ago. The absence of a trip since then is a sign that ties were strained. Brexit was a factor in the cooling of relations. So too were differences between the two governments on the issue of how the troubles in Northern Ireland should be investigated. But Sir Keir Starmer's indicated he wants to rejuvenate the UK's relationship with its close neighbour. This will be his third meeting with an EU leader in recent weeks, following trips to France and Germany. Sir Keir and Simon Harris will discuss trade links with Irish business executives from companies including Primark and Accenture. They'll also go to the UEFA Nations League football match between Ireland and England at the Aviva Stadium.
The new England football manager Lee Carsley has suggested he will not be singing the national anthem before kick-off in Dublin tonight, his first match in charge. The interim boss replaced Gareth Southgate this summer and is hoping to get the permanent job. Carsley, a former Irish international who was born in Birmingham, told the BBC he respected anthems, but singing might distract his focus.
I've never sung the national anthem for Ireland as I want for England. So, and that's just because of my own personal match preparation. I'm fully focused on the game. It was something that when I was playing for Ireland, I always struggled with the wait between warming up, going back into the dressing room, the walk in the tunnel, and then the wait while the anthems were on.
The government is expected to introduce legislation next week to ban landlords in England from evicting tenants without a reason. The Renters' Rights Bill would also extend social housing safety rules to the private sector. More details from our political correspondent Leila Nathu.
A ban on no-fault evictions has long been promised but has been repeatedly delayed. The previous Conservative Housing Secretary Michael Gove had tried to take a renters' reform bill through Parliament but ran out of time before the general election was called. Now it's expected the Labour government will introduce its version into the Commons for the first time next week. It's understood that ministers would seek to enact the ban on Section 21 evictions immediately after the bill became law, rather than waiting for reforms to the court system as the previous government had proposed. Other provisions in the bill would seek to give greater rights to challenge rent increases and to apply what's known as Awaab's Law to the private sector, requiring landlords to fix hazards within a certain time frame. It's named after two-year-old Awaab Ishaq, who died as a result of exposure to mould in his family's home in Rochdale in 2020.
The United Nations has called for an investigation into the death of an American-Turkish woman in the occupied West Bank. Witnesses said she was shot by Israeli forces during a protest. Israel's military said its troops had fired at a man who'd posed a threat and said it was looking into the incident. From Jerusalem, here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
According to friends, Aishana Ezgiadi had only recently arrived from the United States. The 26-year-old graduate from Washington University in Seattle was taking part in a weekly protest against an illegal settlement near Nablus in the West Bank. Witnesses and Palestinian officials said Israeli soldiers shot her in the head. The Israeli Defense Forces said its soldiers had fired at an instigator of violent activity who was throwing rocks, and the incident was under review. Stefan Dujarric, spokesman for the United Nations Secretary General, said there should be a full investigation and people should be held accountable. A White House spokesman said the killing was deeply disturbing and said the US had asked Israel to investigate. President Erdogan of Turkey condemned Israeli forces for what he called their barbaric intervention.
Boeing's Starliner spacecraft has returned to Earth, but without the astronauts it was supposed to be carrying. The capsule suffered several technical problems during its test flight to the International Space Station, and NASA decided it was too risky to bring the crew home. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, watched the landing.
Touchdown. Starliner is back on Earth.
This was the moment Boeing's Starliner spacecraft returned to Earth. After a six-hour journey, it opened three large parachutes to slow its descent before landing in the desert of New Mexico. But instead of having NASA's Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams on board, the capsule was empty. The astronauts had watched it undock and depart from the International Space Station, where they'll now remain. They're waiting to return home with rival company SpaceX, but not until February next year, extending what was supposed to be an eight-day mission to 8 months. Now Starliner's back, both Boeing and NASA will be poring over data from the spacecraft. They'll need to fix the multiple technical problems that plagued this test mission if the spacecraft is to fly again.
Italy's culture minister has resigned after appointing his mistress as an advisor. Gennaro Sangiuliano had been embroiled in controversy since Maria Rosario Boccia revealed her new job last month. The culture ministry initially denied her claims, but Ms. Boccia has released a secret recording with pictures of her with the minister at public events. For the first time in recent memory, a major section of the M62 Transpennine motorway is completely closed this weekend, affecting tens of thousands of drivers. A railway bridge is being replaced near Rochdale. Danny Savage reports.
The M62 is the principal road linking some of the biggest cities in the north of England. This weekend's closure is between Manchester and Leeds, close to Junction 19, to allow Network Rail to replace an ageing bridge. Drivers looking to cross the Pennines are being advised to use alternative routes, including the A69 between Carlisle and Newcastle and the A66 Penrith to Scotch Corner. Delays are expected. Network Rail says the closure of the M62 could not be avoided and the road should be reopened by 6 o'clock on Monday morning. But the motorway will be completely closed again in the same place in 2 weekends' time.
Tennis, and the British men's number one Jack Draper says he gave it his all after being defeated in a grueling US Open semi-final. The 22-year-old lost in straight sets to the world number one Jannik Sinner at Flushing Meadows. Draper was sick three times on court, which he put down to nerves on a big occasion. He said afterwards he couldn't have fought harder.
There's nothing more I can do, honestly. I'll probably look back at the match and sort of see myself struggling a bit. But I know in the moment when I was out there, I couldn't do any more. You know, I was fighting to give everything. I'm just not quite there yet.
That was the British men's number one, Jack Draper.
Alan, thank you very much. The time is 8:10. Three unions, including Unite, which has more than a million members, called on the government last night to reverse its decision to means test winter fuel payments. As things stand, most pensioners will now lose the payments of up to £300 just as their fuel bills rise. At its conference in the coming days, the TUC will vote on whether to oppose the new policy, which affects England and Wales, although the Scottish government has taken its own action in line with it. How much political difficulty or at least discomfort is this issue going to cause Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves in the coming weeks? At least 10 Labour MPs are among those who've signed an early day motion, a request for a debate in the House of Commons, this one asking for the policy to be reconsidered and for a delay in its implementation. Other MPs are deeply unhappy. Rosie Duffield, who's been the Labour MP for Canterbury and Kent since 2017, has been talking to us. And I asked her first how much response she'd had from constituents on winter fuel payments.
Much more than I was anticipating, actually. I think all MPs have been inundated with emails. It's not just from those constituents affected, it's also their families and people who are really concerned about the most vulnerable of those constituents. So people who've got ongoing health concerns, learning disabilities, the absolute most vulnerable of the older people are the people that we've got to look out for.
And they're not reassured, or are they not informed about what the government is saying, that there will be other support? The state pension is being boosted above inflation and increased to the household support fund, and those on pension credit will continue to get this.
That's obviously really helpful, but it just doesn't go as far as they need. And so many of them are going to fall through those gaps. And I think particularly relatives seem terribly angry and terribly anxious. And I've had letters, I think we all have, from people who are suffering from ongoing illness like cancer, and their doctors are telling them how important it is to keep warm. And I think colleagues like Rachel Maskell, who've stressed the public health aspect of this, you know, she's right. Human life is our job to protect, and we know that these people are going to feel cold and it is going to affect their health.
So what's your big worry?
That's my biggest worry, that we're actually going to see people die. We know that the End Fuel Poverty Coalition says that about 4,950 people, you know, we had those excess deaths last year caused just by cold alone.
Were you taken entirely by surprise by this decision, which has come early in the time of the new government and which was not in the manifesto?
Yeah, I was actually. I think many MPs feel the same. It just feels particularly brutal.
And how will it lead you to act? If there is a vote on this, perhaps one this week, what will you do?
Well, we've seen what happens when people vote against the government, which is a shame considering we have such a huge mandate. But I won't be voting for this cut.
You'd be abstaining instead?
Yeah, I think that's probably the only choice I've got.
And tell me, when you refer to how the government has responded to its own MPs voting against, you're referring to the vote on the two-child benefit cap. How did you vote on that?
I actually had COVID, but having campaigned against that particular thing for 8 years, I felt that I would have had no choice but to vote against it.
Right. But you're not prepared to do the same if there is a vote on this?
No, I think the government have made it very clear to MPs how they're going to behave towards us if we do vote against, which makes for a very difficult choice. But those of us who feel perhaps a bit more comfortable abstaining and know, you know, a bit more about being in Parliament are going to abstain, I think, to make the point that we're there for our constituents more than we are for our party, I'm afraid. You know, the Prime Minister has said very often, country before party. And in my case here, it's very definitely constituents before party.
You were never close. Indeed, you had strong differences, didn't you, with the leadership of your party. They'll probably regard you as one of the usual suspects against them.
Very probably. But I think, you know, my job is, as I say, to represent my constituents, not to sort of just suck up, really, if you like, to the leadership. And, you know, I think it's very important for those of us who have been there before to make a point, because perhaps the newer or younger MPs don't feel quite so safe doing that at this stage of their career, I think.
It seems very unlikely that they're going to reverse this decision. What are the other ways that you think could be a way through this, or a way to help more of the people that you are worried about? Ed Balls, who is married to the Home Secretary as well as a former Labour minister, has suggested that they do need some kind of escape route.
Yeah, and actually he's been really clear in saying that he thinks the government needs to be more creative. I think that's the key. There are so many charities and NGOs and people like Martin Lewis who have suggested alternatives to this, like looking again at council tax bans. And, you know, the people themselves that don't need the benefit are absolutely right that we shouldn't just be sort of handing it to everyone. But the means testing does seem to have come down very hard on those who just are going to be just a tiny bit above the threshold, and they're really going to suffer with the rises on the 1st of October. So we do need to think again and think about different ways to do that. I'm not going to pretend to be an economist, but surely we could think again.
I was looking back at the Labour manifesto this morning, and I noticed that a pensioner called Gary, who is quoted in it in relation to the setting up of GB Energy, says this: "I've never struggled this much to keep warm. I can only afford to heat one room with a small portable heater. Sometimes I sleep in my armchair to save money. It's no way to live." I mean, I don't think either of us know whether he is someone who's going to lose his winter fuel payment.
I think that's pretty awful to hear, actually. And we know that pensioners living on just £13,000 a year will lose out, and that's nowhere to live. I think I find it particularly shameful that as MPs, the lowest paid MPs, backbenchers like me, just, you know, get £91,000 a year. And here we are making these decisions that will affect people on £13,000. I'm really ashamed about that.
Rosie Duffield, MP. Thank you. And let's turn to Nick Watt, political editor of Newsnight. For the wider picture on all of this, how much disquiet would you say there is, Nick? And is it something that is building with the unions now, as well as MPs like Rosie Duffield?
Yes, building with the unions, because there's that vote at the TUC on Tuesday, and then potentially two votes in Parliament on Tuesday, definitely one vote. We are clearly heading towards a rebellion, because there are now 12 Labour MPs who've signed that early day motion saying for this to be postponed. And on top of those 12 Labour MPs, there are six independent MPs who were elected as Labour MPs in July and lost the whip over that vote you were talking about on the two-child cap. And they've been told you need to be on good behaviour if you want to come back into the fold. But I wonder whether potentially Keir Starmer is heading into territory which for him could be more politically dangerous than a rebellion. And that is many, many, many Labour MPs, some of whom are incredibly loyal to the Prime Minister, feeling deeply, deeply uncomfortable about this and either abstaining or voting and feeling very, very unhappy. I mean, I have spoken to so many loyalists about this, and they think a terrible mistake has been made.
Do you think there is going to be any kind of bending, anything extra added to the policy, or does that make the government look weak?
All the word from the government is absolutely not. I was talking last night. One senior figure said to me, no U-turn. The position is the position. That's it. From inside the Treasury, if you can't do difficult stuff now, when can you do difficult stuff? But they are pointing to things like the Prime Minister making clear in the Commons on Wednesday that they're very keen to identify those 800,000 pensioners entitled to the pension credit who have not claimed it, which would mean if they did that, they would then keep the winter fuel allowance. And also pointing out that the pension triple lock means that the state pension will increase, should increase by £1,000 over the next 5 years.
But there'll still no doubt be many poorer pensioners who will remain affected by this. And with Rosie Duffield saying her big worry is that someone is going to die, essentially die of the cold this winter.
Well, and Labour MPs are saying that. So Rachel Maskell, who's one of the Labour MPs who has signed this early day motion, has made that exact point, that when you get low temperatures, you have increased risk of stroke, heart attack, pneumonia and hypothermia. And she talked about how she's worried that there may be more excess deaths. And a number of Labour MPs are pointing to a statement by the Royal College of General Practitioners in Northern Ireland, making this exact point about worry for people who will struggle in the cold and struggle with those dangerous health conditions.
Nick Watt, political editor of Newsnight, thank you.
It's just coming up to 20 past 8. Now, back in May, a jury in New York convicted Donald Trump on 34 counts of falsifying business records. But now, the judge in the case has decided to delay the sentencing of the hush money trial until after the US presidential election in November. A little earlier, I caught up with Mike Murphy, commentator and political strategist behind some major Republican campaigns, having worked with the likes of John McCain over the years. He gave me his reaction to the sentencing postponement.
I was not completely surprised. It's a bad day for Trump, and he went and did an unhinged press conference afterward that was not a day his campaign people would have enjoyed, or, you know, earlier today. The reason I was not surprised is in our system, the judiciary is an independent branch, and culturally, they really hate to do anything that can be criticized as affecting an election. If you're a judge, the mentality goes, and I disagree with this, but the mentality is I can rule on the law, but the timing of when the ruling is announced may affect the election, and that's a corrupting thing I shouldn't do. So they're massively timid during election years. Doesn't mean they won't come to the same conclusion, but when a lot of appeals show up, there tends to be a cultural, bias or a cultural interest in kind of wimping out and trying to avoid the election. Here we are, you know, it's approximately 60 days in a tied presidential election, and most judges are afraid of that. So I was not surprised that the appeals worked.
Why do you say it's a bad day for Trump?
Well, because Trump, of course, being somewhat unhinged, immediately went out and held a long rambling press conference where he repeated every charge. There's no joke in American politics. From Lyndon Baines Johnson, the tough old Texas politician in a campaign, they said to him before he was president, when he was a senator, sir, we can't put that out. It's not true. And LBJ said, yeah, I just want to hear the son of a bitch deny it 30 times, you know, and fill the newspapers with denials, because then people think it's kind of true.
A very different time, though. A very different time, Mr. Murphy. Like these days, is it actually moving the dial at all if something like this happens?
Well, our dial is pretty welded. It doesn't move a lot. You've got 45% of the country are pretty firmly locked in for each of these people. And the rest, you know, are kind of split almost equally, if a little more flexibility. So I think if the news cycle, because we have, you know, nonstop cable and internet, just like you guys do, if the next 48 hours is Donald Trump angrily repeating every charge against him, doesn't help. He'd rather be on the offense ideologically against Kamala Harris. So do I think it breaks his campaign? No. But I think it's another log on the proverbial bonfire here that doesn't help.
So that is how he's reacting to this announcement that you're saying is making it a bad day for him. What about merely the fact that we will now not know the decision of the judge on what the sentence should be for the criminal conviction until after the election?
Yes, there's a very narrow window now before, if he wins, if he's sworn in as president, and then he'll test the legal system again by trying to pardon himself. So my guess is the result will land right after the November elections, but before the January inauguration, should he win. Should he lose, he'll be totally vulnerable. So it is maybe political good news for him to punt the problem, but it's very hard to escape the problem unless he's elected president, which he might be.
What do you make of Kamala Harris's start to her campaign?
I think it's been remarkably good. I mean, it's the big movie over here is Twister, about the huge tornado, and it reminded me of that. There was such an emotional depression in the Democratic Party because nobody thought Biden would win, and they saw the terrible specter of Trump on the horizon. Then the big tornado of relief when Joe Biden said, okay, I'm not going to run, new candidate. There was this huge tornado of joy, and it picked her up like a parked semi-trailer and put her 400 feet in the air. Now she's flying. And she managed that pretty well, but it was not, she didn't create that. She was riding around along with a much bigger force. Now the tornado is dissipating and she's going to have to go earn it. And the next moment is going to be the debate. But so far they have made no major mistakes, and they've gone from being an almost certain loser, the Democrats, to Trump, to I think having a small but not unimportant edge in many of the key states. So far, so good. A lot of us who do politics professionally know that the last time she didn't have a tornado carrying her along, she was a flawed candidate and had a lot of problems. So has she improved? We're going to see in the next 20 days as she goes through what we call in American politics, the second look, you know, post-convention, post-hoopla, post-she's new and interesting. And how she handles that, I think, will determine the outcome. I do believe she has in front of her more tools to run a winning campaign than Trump does. So if she does everything right, I think she can win. It'll be kind of like Keir Starmer's Ming Vaz strategy for her. Eliminate risk, show she can survive the second look, do well in the debate, not be bullied by Trump, and then kill the clock every day. Because we're, you know, 60 days out, and we have so much early mail-in voting here, the election day is 10 days long.
You've been a part of some of the major Republican campaigns over the years, you know, John McCain, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the like. What does Donald Trump need to do to win?
He needs to put the focus not on him, because he's not popular. The country gives him one pillar of popularity. They perceive Trump is better at running the economy than Biden. The Trump campaign is trying to define her as bad as Biden. If they win that definition battle, they are likely to win. So her job is to keep the focus a negative referendum on Trump. Trump's job is to make it a negative referendum on her. She's Biden light. She's going to ruin the economy. I'll help the middle class have a better economic life. And that's the real fight of the campaign. Who the middle class during the last 10 days of this election as they mail in ballots thinks will be better for them economically.
Mike Murphy, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
26 minutes past eight, so it is time to get the sports news with Delith Lloyd. Morning, Delith.
Sean, good morning again. The post-Gareth Southgate era begins for England this evening. Interim manager Lee Carsley takes charge for the first time against Republic of Ireland in Dublin. Many of the back pages, though, and indeed the front pages of the papers this morning, leading with the story that Carsley won't be singing the national anthem. Our football correspondent John Murray is in Dublin. John, this could be something that may divide opinions amongst fans.
Yes, Lee Carsley's first match as the England interim head coach and his first diplomatic incident. So I would ask you, Delath, in his shoes, what would you do? He was born in England, in Birmingham, but over the past week he's very much underlined his family roots in rural Cork. He was there this summer for a family reunion. It is the Republic of Ireland he played international football for, 40 caps, played at the World Cup for them. This summer he was approached about perhaps instead becoming the new manager of the Irish team. Yet, in recent years, he has been the coach of the England under-21 team. So what is he going to do? He is, as you say, not going to sing either anthem, which, he told me last night, is simply his being consistent.
When I was playing for Ireland, I always struggled with the weight between warming up, going back into the dressing room, the walk in the tunnel, and then the wait while the anthems were on. It's because usually in the Premier League, it was quite quick, so... Yeah, it's been no different when I've been coaching England under-21s. It's really in that zone and preparing for the game.
So there we are. Although I should point out that whatever hostility here there is in the stadium is more likely to be directed at Declan Rice, the England midfielder who actually played three times for Ireland before switching his allegiance to England. And also Jack Grealish as well, recalled to the England squad by Lee Carsley, a former Republic of Ireland under 21 player of the year.
Yeah. And in terms of the football then, John, I mean, what will the fans want?
Simple. They want the kind of results Gareth Southgate got, but also exciting, attractive, front foot football performances, making the most of the attacking talents that England has, i.e. what was lacking in England's run to the final of the Euros. Whether that's too much to ask right from the start, we'll find out later if Lee Carsley's team are able to make it sing.
We certainly will, John, as ever. Thank you for joining us on today. John Murray out in Dublin. He'll be commentating on the match for Five Live and BBC Sounds. It kicks off at 5 o'clock. Well, Craig Bellamy's first match in charge of Wales ended goalless against 10-man Turkey in Cardiff last night. He called his side's performance outstanding. Let's speak to BBC Wales football correspondent Rob Phillips, who commentated on the game. Rob, despite the result, plenty of reasons, it seems, for optimism for Welsh football fans.
Yeah, it was. It was a different approach with Craig Bellamy. They were on the front foot. In fact, all the things that John Murray said that England fans want, Wales fans had last night, apart from the most important thing, a goal. But I think people were surprised when Sauber Thomas, hasn't featured for over a year, was starting, and he played really well. There was a real dynamism about the Wales performance. And considering some of the absentees that they had, I think it was very encouraging for Craig Bellamy. As I say, all they lacked really was a cutting edge. That will be a concern for Bellamy, but they go to Montenegro on Monday in really good spirits after a performance which has really heartened Wales fans.
Yes, it certainly has. And in terms of Bellamy himself, how did he take the task of management? What was he like on the touchline?
Well, it was fascinating to watch him, Delith, because we know Craig Bellamy always played on the edge. He wouldn't have been the same Craig Bellamy without being like that. He was emotional on times, but it never boiled over. Indeed, I would say he spent most of the time with his hands above his head applauding what he was seeing on the pitch. He called the players over whenever required to just give them a bit more instruction. And I think, amazingly, last night, I think the most astonishing thing of all was he's had 4 days in camp, so many training sessions, very few really, and he got so much information to them. It was a different style, and I think people are really encouraged for the future.
Rob, thanks for joining us. Rob Phillips, BBC Wales' football correspondent. Finally, Jack Draper says he couldn't have given any more as his US Open run ended at the semi-final stage. The British number one lost in straight sets to the world number one, Jannik Sinner, in a grueling and gripping contest which saw Draper vomit 3 times on court.
Thanks, Delath.
It's been a summer of spectacular concerts from the BBC Proms, with stunning performances and unique collaborations. Culminating in the world's biggest classical music party. The last night of the Proms. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
The weather, meanwhile, cloudy towards the south with showery, but drier and sunnier for many further north.
That caught me
sherry
out.
Rain, sorry.
It caught me out an hour ago as well, Michelle.
I didn't learn from that.
And the time is an hour later than it was an hour ago, 8:31 now. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Sean Farrington, and a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Donald Trump has said his conviction in his hush money trial should be terminated after a judge in New York delayed his sentencing until after November's presidential election. The judge said the delay was to maintain fairness during the campaign. Keir Starmer is visiting Dublin for talks with the Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris, who hailed it as an important reset of relations. It's the first time a British Prime Minister has visited the Republic since Boris Johnson 5 years ago. The government is expected to introduce legislation next week to ban landlords in England from evicting tenants without a reason. The Renters' Rights Bill also extends social housing safety rules to the private sector and looks to make it easier for renters to own pets. The United Nations has called for an investigation into the death of an American Turkish woman in the occupied West Bank. Witnesses said Ayşe Nur Ezgiagi were shot by Israeli forces during a protest. Israel's military said its troops had fired at a man who was throwing rocks.
Thanks, Alan. Now, it should come as no surprise to anyone. Dame Sarah Storey entered a cycling race at the Paralympics, came out and took gold for the 19th time in a 32-year Paralympic career so far. Since she claimed that one yesterday, Paralympics GB has gone on to surpass the number of golds won in Tokyo 3 years ago. Reached 100 medals for the game so far as well. Here's the Channel 4 commentary team describing the moment yesterday when Dame Sarah won that gold medal in the women's C45 road race.
It's youth against experience. Gauguin comes again. What has Sarah Storey got left? Has she done it? She has! Oh, what a story! A 19th gold medal. You didn't doubt her, did you?
Surely nobody doubted anybody who was watching. I've got Dame Sarah Storey with me, with us on the programme once again. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I don't know if you've heard that a few times already, but when you listen to it, does it take you back to the moments, the how close that race was yesterday?
Yeah, a little bit. It's funny because you're focusing so much on, you know, the process that you need to go through to try and win. So it's lovely to watch it back, and it was just so close. And I felt like once I went past her, I had it under control, but it was obviously a very long sprint to the line.
Well, just a bit of disturbance on the line there. I don't know, a bit of a rustling of a mic somewhere along the way, but I think that's nice and clear now. Just a couple of days ago, Dame Sarah, you were talking to Nick on this programme, and he was asking you, yeah, can you still keep the energy? And you said every single race is different. Was this one a little bit different? It looked a bit different to your victories in this race that you've had in previous games.
Yeah, it was very different. I mean, it was a different type of course. Every course is different. The hill wasn't as long as the hill we had at the games in Tokyo or in Rio. The London Games, we were circling round Brands Hatch because they'd used the Brands Hatch circuit, and then they'd also used a bit of the outside. And in Beijing, we were around a reservoir. So every race location is incredibly different.
But how narrow it was at the end, the skills you had to use, the learning different languages.
Yeah, well, yeah, pay attention in school, kids. But yeah, no, it was a bit more like a circuit race in some sections, and done lots of circuit racing over the years of being a cyclist. And it was that experience, as Simon Brotherton said there on commentary, being able to judge a finish, knowing how far it was from where she attacked to the finish, and knowing that final corner was actually quite a long way out anyway. So there was plenty of time left in the race when she did attack, but I just had to time it right.
And just explain my language's reference, because you mentioned after the race that you were having to use other skills that weren't just on the bike.
Yes, yeah, so the French coach shouted next lap on the left, so I made a mental note of where that was, because I knew that he wanted her to attack early. Her sprint, I mean, it was an incredible sprint that she tried to come back again after I'd taken the lead in the final couple of hundred metres, but her actual top speed isn't as high as mine, so he knew that she needed to attack early to try and get a gap to try and beat me. So thankfully I was able to respond to that and preempt it. But yeah, every race is just so different, and I've never had to win a race in that way before, which made it all the more exciting for me in a way, as well as everybody else.
And I'm sure it was very exciting for Claire Balding, who's been leading the Paralympics coverage on Channel 4. Morning, Claire.
I will say straight away, not leading it, very much part of a fabulous team, but delighted again to witness Sarah's brilliance. And given that she's been part of every Paralympic Games since 1992, and she has an ability to make very, very hard things look straightforward. So everyone goes, oh, it's another goal for Sarah Story. You're thinking, did you see that? Did you see how close that was? How hard it was? And just to stay motivated, I think, is, you know, huge, huge credit to her that she still wants it so much and commits to training every day and turns up and delivers. It's amazing.
Can you put into a bit of perspective, Claire, because almost taking it for granted, getting Dame Sarah on twice in 3 days on this programme, that we don't take this kind of success for granted. How difficult is it? You've covered so many of our great athletes. You present alongside many of them now. What words would you use to describe Dame Sarah's achievements?
She is stupendous. She really is. And it's a lovely... Simon Brotherton's one of the best commentators we have. And he weaves so wonderfully into that, the use of her surname, because this is an amazing story. And what she continues to do and how calm she is under pressure. And she'll talk, you know, as every professional athlete does, about process and staying in the moment. But actually, when you look at the broad picture of what she's done, it is quite exceptional. And, you know, I work a lot with the swimming team now, and Sarah started as a swimmer. And actually, swimming's been an amazing feeder sport into cycling, into triathlon, into paracanoeing as well, into other sports. But what I would love to know from Sarah, because she's seen it even more than I have, I've only been covering Paralympics since 2000, what has changed? What has grown? How has she seen it develop? Because she's got an overview that very few people would have.
I think Claire, with the quietness of the line now, I think we've actually lost Dame Sarah briefly. So we'll hold that question for the moment. I just wonder what you can tell us, Claire, about these games. You know, there's still a couple of days competition left to go, but you know, for Paralympics GB reaching 100 medals, how they compare, you know, both in the events and the games as a whole to previous ones you've covered.
I have to credit Paris, because honestly, I didn't think anyone could do as good a job of London as of genuinely making it a parallel games, because that's what it's meant to be. Right from the beginning, so they had the Agitos, which is the Paralympic logo, on the Arc de Triomphe, and they've got the Olympic rings on the Eiffel Tower. And the Americans and various other broadcasters said, what's that thing on the Arc de Triomphe? We can't use that. And they said, no, we're hosting two events here. You can use it, and you need to say what it is. And everything has been planned as two massive major sporting events, but also the impact of the Paralympic Games, more than anything else I cover, is the ripple effect it has out into society and into countries that aren't necessarily as open-minded and forward-thinking as France and the UK. Now, we still have a long way to go. I'm not saying we've got it right, but we're doing things around these games that, certainly with the Channel 4 coverage, that have never been done before. We've got 25% of the production team and 80% of the on-air team have a disability. So Rose Ayling-Ellis, who is my co-presenter, who's been absolutely sensational, has taught me more about the art of communication and about teamwork. She's the first deaf presenter to be doing live shows back-to-back every day on a big sports event. And I was talking to Libby Clegg at breakfast this morning, who is the first blind pundit to work on athletics. And she said, oh, my word. She said, gosh, I admire what Rose is doing. She said, the sensory overload of that place, there's so much going on. And, you know, it's a big arena and it's very noisy. Now, she can hear some of that noise. But obviously, in terms of I'm wearing talkback, she can't hear talkback. So she's got a signer who's signing her the talkback, and she's got a signer who's signing what I say or what a guest says. And it's one of those classic things. You'll be sitting there listening, thinking, well, how does that work? And I would say, watch it. And it works. And it's a real case of, you know, I remember an editor once saying to me about writing, said, show, don't tell. Show them how this works. Show them how it happens. And I really think the Paralympic Games, and indeed, I hope the coverage of it, shows you what is possible. And we've got, you know, so many people are going to sports clubs now to find accessible sports. And that, for me, is the real triumph of this, as well as the medals performance from the athletes.
Claire, it's Michelle. I wanted to come in because, you know, we were talking to Rose Ayling-Ellis last week about how she was doing this, and she said she's got one of the other things she has is a board up under close to the cameras where with instructions, I think, and a sort of traffic light system. And she said that, you know, other people like you were looking, thinking, this is quite useful.
It is, Michelle. I tell you what, but she does. It's amazing now that we're right near the end, how little is going on that board. I look at Rose and I know if she's got a question or not. She always has a question. She's always got something and she sees things that I don't see. She asked a question. Obviously, we were doing Gordon Reid and Alfie Hewitt, who won gold yesterday. First time they've won the doubles title at the Paralympic Games. It completes the set for them. It was brilliant. And she said to me before the game started, she said, do they have different chairs or different tyres for different surfaces, for grass or clay? And I went, I don't know. We'll have to ask Louise Hunt, because obviously you have different shoes for clay or grass or hardcourt. And the answer is no, they don't, but they do something different with the casters, the little wheels at the back. They come higher for either grass or clay. But I thought, fantastic. That is a really, you know, those are things I am not thinking. And so it's been, honestly, one of the real joys of my life to work with her and to I think I've learned a lot from her, and we've had a lot of fun. Yeah. Honestly, well, we laughed so much.
The coverage has been brilliant. Congratulations on all of it.
Thanks
so much for coming on this morning. The time is now, 22 minutes to nine, and a 26-year-old American woman was shot dead yesterday as she took part in a protest against the seizure of land by Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. Aisha Noor Ezgi Egi was killed, according to the UN rights group, by Israeli forces who were shooting towards a group of protesters with a shot to the head. The White House says it's deeply disturbed and it's seeking more information from the Israeli government. In a statement given to us, the Israeli military said forces responded with fire towards an instigator of violent activity who hurled rocks at the forces and posed a threat to them. And they say they are looking into reports that a foreign national was killed as a result. Jonathan Pollock, who's an Israeli activist opposed to settlements and part of the same protest as Aisha Noor, spoke to the World Service.
What happened today is no accident. It is the continuation of the killing of 17 of Beta's residents during demonstrations since 2021. It is an intentional killing that is now receiving the light of day because she is an American citizen. It was an intentional killing that cannot be justified.
Well, Beta, which he mentioned, is a town near Nablus in the occupied West Bank, where there is a Jewish settlement called Eviatar, which began as an outpost, illegal under Israeli law as well as international law. Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, joins us now. And we're speaking just as the more than a week-long Israeli raid into Jenin in the West Bank concludes. So we'll come to that in a moment, Jeremy. But what do you make of this news and the way that this woman died?
Well, the issue, Michelle, as you've said, is the way that the Israelis are going about dealing with demonstrations and the questions about whether or not they are essentially using live fire as riot control rather than non-lethal methods. And the allegation, not least made by Jonathan Pollock, who you just heard from, is that routinely that they use live fire to try to push back crowds. He said elsewhere that the incident happened when the soldiers were about 150 yards away from her and when things were pretty calm, and she was then shot in the head. So clearly there's a lot to look into here. I mean, there are precedents more than 20 years ago now. Two activists from the same international solidarity movement, Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old American, and Tom Herndl, a 22-year-old British guy, were both killed by the Israelis in Gaza when they were trying to help civilians from their point of view. And after those incidents, those killings on both of them, both sets of circumstances and the way that the Israelis responded were condemned by human rights organizations. And even April last year, 62 British MPs in the Commons signed an early day motion on the anniversary of Tom Herndl's death, talking about the culture of impunity in the actions of settlers and the army in the occupied territories.
Jenin, 10 nights, I think, and 9 days of this Israeli operation. What do we know about what the Israelis said they've achieved and what the people of the area say the impact was on them?
Well, the Israelis say they're going after people who are planning and trying to kill Jewish citizens of their country, that these are legitimate security operations, and that they are using force within the rules. Now, others are saying that, in fact, this is just the latest example of the rising tide of force being used by the Israelis in civilian areas in the West Bank. And there are fears as well that the kind of techniques that have been used extensively in Gaza in terms of airstrikes, nothing like the degree, but the principle, are being used increasingly in the West Bank. And in fact, the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant used the phrase reportedly, saying that this was mowing the grass, which is the phrase they always used about Gaza when periodically they would go in, cause a lot of damage, kill some people, and give the message that Israel is always going to be there, that Israel will fight its enemies, and if you take up arms against Israel, then the worst is going to happen to you. But of course, there's also a lot of concern about the damage that the Israelis do to civilian infrastructure, not least using these combat bulldozers, which are fearsome vehicles, to rip up roads, destroy electricity facilities, to smash drains, things like that. And the questions being asked are, what exactly has that got to do with Israeli security? Is that, in fact, collective punishment?
Jeremy Bowen, international editor, thank you.
It's 12 minutes to nine. Changes to laws around assisted dying could well be debated by politicians in the House of Commons after the Labour MP for Rother Valley, Jake Richards, was allocated some time in Parliament for an issue of his choice to be officially discussed. And we're joined now by Mr. Richards. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Why assisted dying laws as the issue that you'd like discussed, and how would a bill on it look from your perspective?
Well, in answer to your first question, this is an issue that now hasn't been debated or aired in Parliament for over a decade. And increasingly, people are feeling that they want a change in this area of the law. People are affected by what's going on in their families' lives and their loved ones who are suffering unnecessarily at the end of their life. So there is a hunger for change, and Parliament for too long have ignored that hunger. I came out of the ballot this week in a private member's ballot, and will be bringing forward a narrow piece of legislation, cautious reform in this area, to give people choice at the end of their lives.
It's been an issue much discussed on this programme. We had plenty of reaction from listeners about it as well. Earlier this year, we spoke to Dr. John Sorrell, a retired GP, who we've spoken to about this subject many times in the past. His wife sadly passed away from end-stage Parkinson's disease. And we can hear a little bit from him now. He believes we should focus on palliative care rather than assisted dying.
We have to be careful. There are so many potential risks if there's not tight guidelines into how things are done. And it does vary from country to country around the world, as I read through the evidence the select committee's produced. If it's not well controlled, it will be abused. And there is some evidence that as it goes on in countries that have been doing it for a few years, the number of assisted deaths is increasing. And the definition of what should happen, like the person's in the last few months of their life and things, it gets greyer, and it seems to be more and more things get put into what's allowed. And that's what worries me about introducing assisted dying in the UK.
What do you say to people like Dr. Sorrell who have that view?
About any changes need to be undertaken incredibly carefully. The bill that I'll be putting forward will be a modest reform about those who have 6 months or less to live with full capacity to make their own decisions. Some people want us to go further. I'm very aware of the concerns that Dr. Sorrell just raised and others have raised them as well. And I think modest reform, careful reform in this area is the way forward. But I would also just stress this argument about palliative care. It's not one or the other. And I don't think it's right to simply say to people who are coming to the end of their lives now, well, hold on, wait, we need to get more development in palliative treatment, and perhaps we can help you in the future. It's going to be too late for too many people. So it's not one or the other. But look, this is a big debate, and I respect people who disagree with me on this. Gordon Brown has written a piece recently about the need to focus on palliative care, and of course I respect someone like Gordon Brown. My bill I want to get it in before Parliament so we can have that debate, so that that debate is heard in Parliament and we can come to a conclusion on this. We can't just put our head in the sand on this issue anymore. And that's why I'm pushing for my bill to be heard. And I hope and expect government to give it time.
Yeah, it's a bit of a nuance of how Parliament works, isn't it? That you end up putting your name in a ballot effectively and seeing if you get the time and how much time you get. But if you get that opportunity, would you think the Prime Minister might give your bill more time to ensure it is fully debated, to, you know, alleviate perhaps some of those concerns that so many have?
Yeah, look, Keir Starmer, both before the election and after the election, has confirmed that he will give this issue time if it comes forward through a private member's bill. Now, I'm 11th on the list, so if it's my bill, great. But if it's someone ahead of me, that's absolutely fine as well. And I hope that the government will do that. Give it time for the debate to be had in Parliament. There are strong views on both sides, and then for a free vote. And look, I expect Keir Starmer to stick to his word on that, and I hope that the government will give this issue time.
Because is there a risk the way Parliament works that it isn't given enough time? And, you know, if it's too short a time, you can actually make steps backwards in the wrong direction in this issue.
Well, yes, look, clearly the debate itself has to have a lot of time in the House of Commons. But look, this debate is already happening across the country in pubs and cafes and living rooms. People listening to this programme will then be speaking to their family about their views on it. So this debate is already happening. As an MP, I receive casework on it all the time. And now we need to bring that debate to the House of Commons. That is what the House of Commons is ultimately for. Mm. And so I hope that the government, and indeed the House of Commons generally, whatever side you're on in this debate, take steps to make sure that it's had, because it's not good enough to simply say, well, this is difficult, this is a tricky issue, let's just put our head in the sand, give it half an hour at the end of a Friday afternoon. Let's have a proper debate, let's have a vote, and let's really seize this issue now.
Jake Richards, MP for Rother Valley, thank you very much.
It is 7 minutes to nine. Laurie Lee would be 110 years old if alive today, and his writing remains much loved nearly 30 years after his death, whether it's his childhood in the Cotswolds, captured inside with Rosie, or walking to Spain in 1935 and returning there during the Spanish Civil War. Now a production that sets his words with music is touring again, starting with the Buxton Opera House next Saturday. It is called Red Sky at Sunrise. Laurie Lee in words and music, and it's with the actor Anton Lesser. Here's part of it.
Never to be forgotten, that first long secret drink of golden fire. Juice of those valleys and of that time. Wine of wild orchards, of russet summer, of plump red apples and roses burning cheeks. Never to be forgotten or ever tasted again.
Well, that, as many of you will recognise, is from Cider with Rosie. But this production puts together a trilogy of stories, not only Cider with Rosie, but As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning and A Moment of War. On the line is David LePage, the artistic director for the Orchestra of the Swan. He arranged the music for the performance. And in the studio is Anton Lesser himself. Welcome, Anton. Wonderful to hear that excerpt. How well did you know the books before you came to play Laurie Lee in this?
Not at all. Absolutely not at all. It's one of those books which you think you must have read, you know, as a child or at school. It's a classic. Oh, yes, I know Laurie Lee. But I hadn't. And when I got the material, I was completely blown away. It was like a revelation. And then the chance to actually speak it, and speak it with the most beautiful music, with... there's a kind of alchemy that takes place when we do it. It's so rich and so magical. And I think for people who know Laurie Lee, it will be a celebration. I think they will love it. For people who don't, like I didn't, it'll be a revelation.
And you say alchemy because you're on stage. I think you're standing at the front and then the live musicians are right behind you. Does it sometimes vary because there might be a moment which you decide to take slower?
Yes.
And the musicians follow you?
Absolutely. And I'm noticing this more and more when we do it. I haven't a musical bone in my body, but I'm noticing, even I am noticing, how they are responding to us and we're responding to them. So it's gone from something being words and then music and then words and music to something that is one thing, which morphs and evolves, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah. David, tell us about the musical side of things. What is the music in this, the music that you've arranged?
Well, these books by Laurie Lee were a gift in terms of choosing appropriate material. There's an arc, a real journey built in over the three books, and it starts off in that kind of pastoral English area. So I chose music by Vaughan Williams, Holst, Walton Elgar, Britten, Percy Grainger. And then that amazing moment where Laurie Lee sees Spain for the first time. We get this solo Spanish guitar music, this Asturias by Albéniz. And it's an amazing moment where Mark, the guitar player, is in the spotlight. And it's such a jolt musically, but it reflects what's happening in the book. He's gone from this incredibly beautiful rural English idyll in Slad and then suddenly wakes up in this parched landscape, and the music reflects that.
So it gives you that sense of place as well. How different was it from anything you had worked on before?
Well, the wonderful thing, Anton mentioned that the orchestra is on stage. I was very keen that the orchestra is communicating with the audience, so facing outwards and communicating with the actors. And it's unusual to see that with an orchestra. Also, we're not dressed in the normal penguin suits, so we're in sort of rustic clothing. And I think that really helps the audience enter into the spirit of the whole thing. But I think it's important that we're communicating face on rather than side on. And so that formality of the classical ritual isn't there so much.
And there's a conductor, presumably, conducting actors and musicians.
No, it's me. So I direct from the violin. So I'm the artistic director of the orchestra, but I'm also the leader as well. So I'm moving my scroll around, so hopefully people can follow that.
Gosh, sorry, you're the lead violinist in the performance and you're directing the whole thing?
Yeah, it's quite a small group, so it's like playing chamber music, so people can really follow your physical cues. And so it's not as difficult as it sounds.
Did you find it difficult, Anton, in the beginning, or did it have just a natural flow from the start?
A natural flow, so natural. I mean, it's a complete joy to do. I mean, I turn up, I don't have to learn any lines.
Because you can have your script.
We read and interact, and it's a kind of, a synthesis between acting a part and telling a story. And so we move in and out of those genres, myself and Charlie Hamblett, the other actor. Mm. And we interact with the musicians too.
And he plays the younger Laurie Lee,
yes,
doesn't he? So
yes.
So you're a double act. And do you have a favourite passage of your own or a favourite moment in the evening?
Oh, there are so many. But I think when it works, the passage that you played, where he's leaving Slad and he turns and looks at his mother, he talks about, I watch the dying light, the golden light die behind her. I turned the corner, passed the village school, and left that part of my life forever. Mm. And that's a big turning point. And when we get it right, the music and that, and the music stops just at a certain moment, it's very moving.
Yeah. We should talk about some of the practical sides. David, where does it go after Buxton next Saturday?
So then we go to Wilton Music Hall in London, wonderful space, from the 25th to the 27th of September. There's four shows there. Then Northampton, Durngate, enormous place, so it'd be great to... Yeah.